This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard. Not billiard. What? Not the billiards. It was... Come on, Rudy. What? Come on. We call it the
place to
the
be.
The place to be. Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
This is the place to be here tonight.
Time to play the game.
Party people in the place to be. Uh-huh. It's about that time.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
I think they might hit a shock wall.
Actually, it's being John Akiyama is a better version of it.
What do you think, Woodling? You can finally tell Grant Owens you found new music.
I'll tell you what, I am impressed.
Mm-hmm. Sharon Lawson Bram, skidamarinky-dinky-dink.
Yeah.
Skidamarinky-do.
Hey, Nate, man, this is pretty much a highlight of my life right now. I had no idea you were going to be here. I've wanted to drive that freaking ho train of my whole youth. You're the man.
And I thought he meant Nate Milton, the Godfather from Kings of Sport. Do you really think that's the Godfather?
Yeah, I did.
All you have to do is break out that fuck money.
I ate the pie. Watch your mouth, you scraggly Canadian.
That's a bit much. You who murdered the dog with the sword, and I'm being a little too much.
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I was just curious. 5 years! 5 years! We've been doing podcasts. And we have this. This is trash.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming to you live here on this Monday evening. And Scott Criscola, we get a little taste of spring this weekend. It was kind of nice.
It was. Good evening, JR. Good evening, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to episode 438 of the Gold Standard. Yeah, it was, let's see, Saturday it was, I think it peaked at maybe like 59, 60, but... I think at one point around here yesterday, I think it was 71.
Oh, wow.
It was consistently like 66, 67 most of the day. But I remember like early afternoon, my car temperature was like at 71. So it was interesting. It was very strange. It was just good because it pretty much just got rid of all of that snow from a week and a half ago, which is very
and
nice.
And there's none in the 10 day either. So I'm kind of, maybe we're done. Maybe
that's what I'm thinking. I feel like we're out of the wind. I've always said, and I've lived in Connecticut, well, as we both lived in New England our whole lives, I feel like the prime window of snow is like mid-December to the end of February. Mm. It's very rare over the last, like, knock on wood, over the last, you know, 15 years, we've gotten like a blizzard in March. Right. I mean, it's possible, but it's very rare that it happens. But, yeah.
It actually wasn't even that bad this winter. I feel like there were never any, like... I remember last year, there were so many days that were so cold. I've never been screenshots of, like, you know, from my phone of it being, like, negative 25 wind chill, like, stuff like that. And I don't feel like we ever really hit that this year.
No, we haven't. And it hasn't gotten, like, ridiculously cold. There was a stretch right after the blizzard we had a week and a half ago where I felt like the snow was never going away. And then by, like, Tuesday...
But that was short.
60% yeah. of it was gone, so...
Anyway,
it was nice, but guess what? The 70 won't be here for.
I don't need that. I just need like no snow and 50. I want to start playing basketball in a few weeks, so that's it.
Oh, I can't wait to get the, I can't wait to put on the arsonist app. That's what I call it, the arsonist app. So.
The score should be out soon. So the Cowboy and I started piecing it together this weekend. So.
Oh, good, and I'm sure. Yeah, didn't you get a new? You guys, well, you didn't get a new net, right? That was 2 years ago, right? You got the new net.
Right, yeah, we're not touching anything this year. Hopefully it's in good shape. But anyway, all right, so yes, here we are. Did you give the episode number yet? I don't remember.
Yes, we did, 438.
Okay. We're back, of course, inside Madison Square Garden, but Scott, we're not alone.
No,
joining us is a guy we've wanted to have on the show for quite a while. He popped in a little bit at Halloween. He was part of the trivia contest, and he did very well. He was impressive there. Of course, I think within Place to Be Nation and Pro Wrestling Only, he's pretty synonymous when it comes to the Garden. He has done many shows featured around it. He, of course, is one of the co-hosts of Titans of Wrestling. I almost said late grade, but we're not quite there yet. He's also one of the co-hosts of Tag Teams Back Again. And he was the sole host of At the Garden, another great series as well. So all of those available on our PWO feed as well as PlayStation.com. And, of course, that can only mean the one and only Mr. Kelly Nelson. Kelly, how are you tonight?
I am doing fabulous. Great to be here.
Awesome. We are very excited.
Honor and privilege.
Yeah, yes. Very excited to have you in the house. And you did do very well in that trivia tournament. I was pulling for you. That was heady territory, those final four, so...
Oh, yeah. Well, I think, yeah, right. I was in the final four, and one of the guys got a 10 out of 10. So at that point, I knew I was in trouble.
You were in the final four, and then somebody gave you the taker chair shot to your eye like Vader. And so you were cooked after that.
Yeah.
It's funny, too, because I feel like people that were on in the first round, like Will, I remember being like, oh, this is awful, because it was. There were so many scrubs in that first round that bowed out. And then he, like, texted me. He's like, oh, you should have done whatever. And I'm like, no, man. I'm like, the final, like, once we went to eight, it got, like, really, really good. Like, that, the first round was kind of, kind of a slog. But once you got past that, it got quite good, I thought.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was so noisy at first. And then, it just got progressively quieter as right. It went on, and more serious. The serious trivia guys were left.
And I'll blame Will solely for all of that.
the noise, it's
all,
yeah.
All his fault.
Slug.
So, Kelly, we mentioned Titans, and Scott and I mentioned it a couple weeks back that, of course, and it's all over the place. It was announced on Titans. It was announced at Pro Wrestling Only and on social media that the show's wrapping up, and the eulogies that have poured out have been fantastic. Like, the comments from everybody have been really, really sincere and heartwarming to read. And I wanted to take a minute just to pay tribute, because in the very early days when we were just figuring out what PlayStation.com was going to be, Titans was one of the first shows to really come on board. We had our show, Scott and myself, and we also had Where the Big Boys Play. And then Titans, I don't know if people realize like how early on that was part of the site and part of the family. I mean, it was pretty much within a month or so of us launching the site that Titans was on board. And I know in the beginning the show was a little bit different format, different hosts, but eventually it rounded into, kind of the Fab Four of yourself, Pete, Parv, and Johnny. And the chemistry was always amazing, and I still have some saved in my phone that I just haven't gotten to yet that I'm, like, treasuring getting through, because you learn so much information, and the laughs and the jokes are natural. Like, nothing ever seems forced. And to say that for Johnny is, like, amazing, like, it's a lot of it's natural, even with him. Yeah. So is there anything you wanted to say? And I know we'll do some plugs later to talk about kind of the final shows, but is there anything you wanted to just talk about the show itself?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the praise that came in, with the announcement was great. We love doing the show. It was, for all of us, like, a highlight of our weeks, when we did them, when we were really doing them regularly.
Right.
The first couple of years, it was great. And yeah, it was just, very casual atmosphere where we just got together. We didn't know each other at all. Like, I'd done one show with Parv, one Where the Big Boys Play. I didn't know Johnny. Like, I knew Johnny through PWO.
Right.
And I knew Pete through there too, but had never spoken to them before. And, there was James, too, at the beginning.
Yes. There was James.
Was the one. Actually, I got to know James quickly, because he was very friendly, let's say, with direct messages. So we established a communication.
That's a very diplomatic way of saying it.
Yeah, it's at the end now. There's no need to bury anybody. But it was just, we of course were wrestling fans, so you have that common ground, and everything just gelled. And we loved talking about the Bob Backlund era WWF, something that not a lot of people like to talk about or watch. It was something I was always into, even when I was very young. I loved watching the old matches on the Coliseum home videotapes. And so, yeah, it was a labor of love. And, it would have been great if we could have kept going and finished it with at least having the end with Backlund losing the title, which was always my sort of vision of it ending. But, life, real life takes over and you get busy, and it's not our job doing podcasts, unfortunately. So, yeah, it just got harder and harder to schedule it. But we went out with a bang. We recorded it on Super Bowl Sunday, the finale, and it's going to drop on Wednesday. So we're very proud. Yeah, very proud of the final. It's going to be great. So, yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, to hearing that, of course. I mean, I'm not, but I am. So, and I felt the same way with Letters from Kayfabe when that went away. I held on to the last episode for a week or so before I finally, bit the bullet and listened. But no, it's a great show, and the archives are all up on PlayStation.com and on the Pro Wrestling Only feed on iTunes. So if you haven't listened to them all, or it's something that's kind of gone, you know, below your radar, if you're newer to the feed or newer to the show here, and you loved that era, it's worth watching. And the cool thing was, too, you guys always found, special things to call out, you know, Super 8 or whatever his name was, guys like that.
Yeah.
You know, of course, all the vintage announcers, and, you know, there were hooks to every episode. So on the surface, you're like, oh, God, I'm going to listen to a podcast, so, you know, Bob Backlund against whoever. But there's so many talking points and conversation pieces, and you being the jobber specialist, and, you know, breaking down the jobber bios and talking about the you know, folks that were always there at these MSG shows a lot of time, or, you know, some of the other buildings, but mainly MSG, that added to it. So it started to give you that, I don't say family feel, but kind of just that nice, like you've said in the past, like that comfort feel of, okay, we're back in the garden, here's so-and-so, here we are.
Yeah, I mean, I said this years ago, how the show more than anything was about being a wrestling fan,
right?
And that the footage we were watching and the Backlund era WWF was kind of just in the background in a sense. And it was just because we would go off, you know, we would tell the story of our fandom numerous times throughout and just go in and out of different things. It was just a show about being a wrestling fan at its heart, I think.
And there's specials in there, too, for everyone. You know, it's Portland. The Portland special. It was a Texas special, too, right? Stampede.
At the end, I was pumping out a bunch of Stampede shows.
Right, right.
There's a Portland. There's a classic St. Louis you guys did early on. Yep. Another Portland. Let's see. Continental.
So that was Pete's baby. We did Georgia.
Yep.
There's a episode part 29. Yep.
Yeah. We did Mid-Atlantic. Couple parts on Mid-Atlantic in the 70s. Not too long ago, Johnny and I did a show on Muhammad Ali versus Antonio Inoki from 1976. We did a whole
show. I'd like to, if you don't mind, Kelly, I'd like to point out an episode that I never got to listen to the whole thing. I listened to some of it, and it was really good. And considering what happened this weekend, I think everyone should listen to episode 34, which was the interview with Ivan Koloff.
Yes,
That should be listened to. It was I never got a chance to listen to the whole thing. I'm going to re-listen to it from the beginning. It was very good, and obviously he's no longer with us. So I highly recommend it. Great, that's a gem for you guys right there, because obviously he can never do one again. So check that one out. That's episode 34 of Titans. Great interview with Ivan Koloff.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, because that was the first wrestler we ever interviewed, and we talked to him for almost 2 hours, which was great. That's a great one. Rest in peace, Ivan. Great wrestler, and very gracious to come on and do our show when we were just starting out, basically.
And you have a bunch of tributes here. You did the one, because obviously you guys did the show during times when some of the greatest passed away. You did one for Vern Gagne. You did a two-parter with for Piper, Roddy Piper, a guy we'll speak about later.
The Piper one was great, yeah.
A bunch of great ones. They're all fantastic. Just listen to them all. There's really
If you're a fan of this show in this era, then Titans is a perfect, I would say, compliment, because it takes you to where we are. And that was my goal, Kelly, when we were talking, Scott, myself, and kind of conferring with Brad and Chad, was I'd love to pick up. Because people have asked, why didn't you start with the Hogan era? And at the time, mostly we didn't know Titans was ending. And I was like, I think 85 is a clean spot, because I didn't envision you guys touching 85. I didn't know if you'd spill into 84 at all. So that's kind of why we figured, there's a nice bridge from Titans right into this. And that's kind of why we picked what we did.
Well, and the thing is, we debated over the years, should we go into 84? Because the original set that James made was 1979 to 1983. And then he made subsequent sets that covered 84 to 89, I think, and then into the 90s. So I was always sort of pro ending it with Bob Backlund tapping out, or not tapping out, getting the towel tossed in by Scullin and his title reign ending, because that, the most of the episodes, the whole run was about Backlund's reign, so it would have been a fitting way to end. But 84 is such a great year for WWF. It's actually maybe my favorite year. It's one of them. Because you have so many great feuds going on. Sheik and Slaughter, Valentine Tito, Piper. Piper's Pit debuted. Hogan's first year as champ. Like, there's so much going on. And then earlier today, I was thinking, damn, it's too bad, because I knew you were kind of, you kind of thought that we would go into 84, and I kind of felt bad that you guys like left us that cushion to go into 84 if we wanted to, and now we're not going to. And then you guys missed out, because maybe you should have started in January 84, but oh well, hindsight is 2020, as they say. So
yeah.
Well, maybe someday.
Jobbers in '84.
I say maybe someday we'll have a one-off series, Kelly, where we can go back to '84. You know, to specialize in that year as a non-PTB or something. We'll see. But
yeah, I think because somebody's got to do '84.
Right.
It's not Titans 10 years down the road when we reunite. It should be you guys.
That'd be good. The Titans reunion tour can go right through '84.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we got to do '83 first.
That's right.
But we'll see.
All right. Well. Anyway, everyone should check out Titans of Wrestling. It's worth the time that we just spent talking about it, and many, many more hours as well. So be sure to go ahead and revisit the archives and check out the final episode this Wednesday. We'll talk again about that at the end of the show. Gentlemen, why don't we go ahead and dive into tonight's topic. Mr. Scott, would you like to set the tone?
Here we go. Tonight, we are going into, of course, Madison Square Garden. JR, our office is upstairs. It is August 10th, 1985, another Saturday night. House show, as you know, JR, and of course you as well, Kelly. Most MSG house shows are on Mondays, but the last few months have kind of bounced around. I think June was in was on a Friday, and July was on a Saturday, so this one's on a Saturday as well. I believe when we get into next month in September, I think it goes back to Mondays. But this is Saturday, August 10th, 1985, from the Garden. The crowd, 22,091, and I don't Gorilla didn't mention that the Felt Forum was open tonight. I think that's all in the big house, in the big room.
Scott, I actually have, I don't know if you've been able to see this feedback here. Our buddy Joe, I'm going to say Ode, O'D, chimed
Joe
in.
Joe O'D?
Yeah, he's been a fan for 42 years of WWE / WWF / WWF, and he kind of threw out some, I don't know if call them corrections or well-said, well-stated facts for us to go back and read, and here's his take on Felt Forum. He said it was only used after the main arena sold out. So if the crowd is in the 20,000 range, they've added the Felt Forum closed circuit. If you see a 15,000 gate, etc., there's no Felt Forum. So now we know going forward. So this show likely had it from what he's saying.
Okay. Yeah, Graham did not have – Graham sometimes will say
right.
Felt Forum on the history of WWE.com. Sometimes he doesn't. This one he didn't, and that was both on the website and his book. I used his book today because obviously it was President's Day. I was off, so I used his book, and he didn't mention it. But 22,000 does seem like a pretty heavy number for that. Now, Kelly, quickly, those early 80s, right, they were mostly in the 20,000s, right? Or were there maybe some dips here and there? But was it mostly between like 18 and 20 for most MSG shows during Bob's run?
Oh, yeah. During Bob's run, I the lowest they got, I think, was 18. I don't think they ever went lower. Like, it was like – the territory was on fire almost
right.
continuously throughout Bob's run, and they sold out the Felt Forum quite frequently too.
Yeah, so there's times probably there was maybe even 27,000-28,000 at times if they really filled the Felt Forum up. So
I feel bad for this crowd. They actually showed up in this this number. This is what they got. We'll see next month if it dipped back down. But
yeah, but
killed the town.
Right, they almost killed the show.
Obviously there was a 1A and 2A. So the 2A house show, a whopping 3,000 miles away, gentlemen, the Anaheim Convention Center, not even the pond yet, the Anaheim Convention Center, very small place, 3,500. Here was your card. I guess, Jared, we won't have Fat Ass tonight. Quick Draw, Rick McGraw. That's actually David Sammartino.
Right, Sammartino.
This is jacked up, the jacked up guy.
Yes.
Quick Draw was 3,000 miles away, defeating Alexei Smirnov. So Rick McGraw, we don't get him, and he wins a match.
There you go. Well, that's where he'd win. Then he'd come here and job.
Yeah. Cousin Junior defeated Moondog. Oh, God, yeah. Moondog. That ring must have stunk. Ricky Steamboat defeated Don Morocco via DQ. That was turning into a pretty hot feud. Tiger Chung Lee defeated Jack Armstrong. Now, this is weird. Graham has Tiger Chung Lee defeated Jack Armstrong with Hillbilly Jim, which is impossible unless this was a matinee, because we'll see Hillbilly a little bit later.
Yeah, but, well, even the matinee with the time change would have been tough for him to come back. So
yeah, I know. That's kind of weird. Anyway, so Tiger Chung Lee defeated Jack Armstrong. Tito Santana, defending his Intercontinental Championship, fought Terry Funk to a draw. Adrian Adonis defeated SD Jones. And in the final match, the Killer Bees, B. Brian Blair and Jumpin' Jim Brunzel, defeated the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkov. So no Hogan there out in Anaheim. We will see if he is here tonight at the Garden. Otherwise, another weekend off for the WWF champion.
He's working the PR tour.
That's right. Speaking of the WWF champion, why don't we go to the Sutton Report? How long has he been champion?
He has been champion 565 days at this point into his reign. And that seems like a lot for us, but Kelly, what's that, like a drop in the backlid bucket, right? That's the
yeah. And San Martino's first run.
That's it, right? That is nothing. They're laughing. Tito Santana, 35 days into his reign. The U.S. Express, Mike Rotundo, Barry Windham, just 54 days into their reign, their second reign as tag champs. And Wendy Richter, 132 days into her reign. Kelly, you're caught up on this show? I just had a quick question for you. The women's match that we talked about, I think it was a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
Desiree and Judy Martin. Have you seen that debacle?
Yes, of course, and I've been recommending it to people because it was an amazing match.
Right?
Yeah. So I mean, I've come to love 80s women's wrestling, WWF women's wrestling.
Judy Martin was a badass, man. She kicked the shit out of her in that match.
Yeah, yeah. No, Judy Martin has a great reputation as one of the best ladies wrestlers ever.
She's on the Albano list for me, the people I've come around to since our original trip through these shows. Right. The people I despised until rewatching them, like, kind of in this era now. So Judy Martin's on the list.
Yeah, no, that match was awesome. That was such an amazing, like, out-of-nowhere match.
It's so random. All right, so why don't we go ahead and get started. And our opener features a guy I believe we saw. No, this is a debut for us here. And that is Paul Roma battling old Charlie Fulton. A little background on Roma, courtesy, of course, of our buddy Jeff Jarvis. Paul Centoponi began his wrestling career training under Tony Altamare. He would make his debut as Paul Roma in December of 84 at WWF All-American Wrestling taping in Poughkeepsie, New York. Began wrestling regularly for the WWF in 1985. Got his first victory against Steve Lombardi in February in Brooklyn, and his first televised win at the Philadelphia Spectrum against Johnny Rods in May. For the first 2 years of his career, he was primarily used as a low-card preliminary wrestler. 1987, he would be teamed with Jim Powers to be the Young Stallions. And Jeff gave a lot of other background on Roma, but we're going to be talking about him a lot, Scott, so maybe we'll save kind of his future for as we move forward here. But this is his debut at MSG for us here tonight. And I think we've seen Charlie Fulton before, though, right?
Yeah, Charlie Fulton, I think, was January or April. We've definitely seen him already, but Charlie Fulton, I always thought, just didn't have an MSG look. He always looked like a mid-Atlantic jobber, like Tony Zane or, you know, Paul Garner, one of those guys that used to be on Saturday nights. But, Charlie Fulton. But Paul Roma, they can't say, JR, that Paul Roma, you know, is putting on a lot of pounds because, I mean, he was ripped. But,
yeah.
But they didn't do like they usually do. You know, oh, my God, this guy is so big. He's put on so much weight. No, he didn't. He's pretty jacked. And Kelly, what are your thoughts on the very early days of Paul Roma? First of all, when I was a kid and I thought I knew every part of New York, I had no idea where Kensington was. I don't know if it was upstate in Albany. I don't know if it was in Yonkers. Like, I had no idea where Kensington was. I think it's somewhere in like north of Poughkeepsie. I think that's where Kensington is. Right? Am I even close? Do you know?
I can check. But yeah, Kelly, what are your thoughts on Roma and also Fulton being the big jobber guy?
Here and there. And yeah, he's just a pretty almost the definition of nondescript as a wrestler. Never, like, his facial expression never changes. It's just stone faced. And not really the most entertaining performer around, as we see in this match. Paul Roma, interesting about him, because I just listened to his appearance on the Stone Cold podcast, kind of in preparation for this show, actually, because I just listened to him the last couple days because I knew we'd be talking about him. And I didn't know much about Roma beforehand, and he has an interesting story because, he got into wrestling. Tony Altamare trained him, but Mr. Fuji took him under his wing right away.
Mm-hmm.
And Fuji was actually a pretty influential guy backstage and a well-known teacher, like a guy who would teach you psychology, something that you wouldn't learn in a wrestling school. Right. Yeah. So Fuji was basically,
odd friendship.
Yeah, I know. But as a result, Roma was kind of like a protected guy backstage.
Right.
And Yeah, because Fuji was one of the elder statesmen, one of the most respected guys. And then later when Harley Race came in, he was part of that group too, and another guy that looked out for Roma. So I found that interesting that Fuji taught him a lot. Roma at this time, I mean, he had just started not too long before, so he didn't know too much. And in the podcast with Stone Cold, he says, you know, it took him a good year until he, it finally clicked. So right. I think we're seeing Roma right now at his greenest almost, where he doesn't really know what the hell he's doing in the ring.
And it honestly didn't, I mean, it showed, but I mean, you know, for someone who's that green and admittedly that green, like, he actually wasn't bad. I guess we'll talk about it in a second, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could have looked worse. It could have looked like Jose Luis Rivera about 6 months ago. Yeah. Now, those were bad.
So, Scott, you were way off on Kensington. It's actually on the island.
Okay.
It's near Great Neck Plaza. Do you know where that is? Great Neck Estates.
I know where Great Neck is. So, all right, so he's a Long Island.
Near Manhasset, yeah. So there you go, Kensington. I would have thought it was upstate as well. So,
yeah, so
Roma fool us all.
D'Amato's neighborhood. Yeah.
And good luck. All right, so Charlie Fulton back here battling the young upstart Paul Roma. Roma comes out hot, battling Fulton and working a side headlock. Alfred credits Roma as for growing as a pro and starting to question things, like how much tape Fulton has on his wrists. So he's giving Roma credit for calling stuff out and paying attention to the little things. Fulton twists into a head scissors, but Roma eventually works free. Fulton buries a knee to the gut to come back, cut him back down. Fulton gets a near fall and grabs a chin lock and uses Roma's hair to keep him in the hold. Roma finally gets free, but Fulton cuts him down again, this time with an elbow for two, and then goes back to the chin lock. Gorilla and Alfred plug Doria's popularity and all the news coverage that's going on now as Roma fights to his feet. Fulton breaks Roma back down and heads right back to the chin lock as the commentary is wavering all over the place. Roma fights out but gets knocked to the floor. Roma tries to climb back in, but Fulton slugs him hard to the floor with a hard bump. Roma recovers again and comes back to the ring with a sunset flip to try and steal the win with a flash pin. Steals him with a flash pin. And I kind of liked what they're going for here with Fulton destroying Roma, but giving him that one window and Roma takes advantage with that path. But everything else was really fucking boring with all the chin locks. It's like they had the roadmap, but they didn't know how to get there. I thought if Fulton had been more varied in his offense, this could have been a little bit better. Roma keeps building the resume here, as green as he is, and I went half a star because I kind of liked the general psychology of the idea of the match, but even though they don't really execute it that well. What'd you think, Scott?
I give it a half star as well. A couple things. I mean, there was two. Like you said, the path to get to this weird ending was, I don't know. They had these two very long rest holds. You had the head scissors, and then there was a really long headlock that Fulton had on Roma. And it was a good 2 or 3 minutes. It was long. At one point, and it's very strange, Alfred says that Charlie Fulton wouldn't talk to him about his time in Korea.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, how fucking old is he? What is he, 70? I mean, if he was in Korea.
Well, maybe he just went there on vacation. Did he want to talk about it?
No, he meant Vietnam.
That's had to be what he talked about. I'm thinking to myself, Jesus Vietnam Christ. Dead. I was going to say, what? That's totally ludicrous. And totally ludicrous. I'm like, oh, he did want to talk about his time in Korea. And I'm like, Korea? What was he, four? Like, it was really weird. And I wasn't sure what to make of the ending. I understood the logic of it where, you know, the upstart rookie steals a quick pin from the veteran while the veteran beat the snot out of him. And let me check the runtime. I'll check it in a minute. But, I mean, literally, I don't know how much – he barely got any offense in.
Right. So 10:45.
It didn't seem that long. But
really? I'd argue it seemed a lot longer.
The rest holds didn't, but the match didn't feel that long. So yeah, I can understand that the frustration here. I'm curious, Kelly, where you think they could have gone or why they didn't go a certain way. I feel like the ending, I felt like it was a legit ending to kind of for the kid to steal the win.
Yeah.
But what was the path? I mean, that was just, all right, I'm going to bore you with headlocks, and then you're going to beat me with a sunset flip. I was like, that seemed to be where they were going, and it didn't execute it properly.
Yeah, well, I think it's like I said, I think it speaks to Roma's greenness that he didn't really know what to do on top as a babyface. Like, there was no, like, he didn't really do anything to get any heat. He was content to sort of just sit in headlocks and chin locks and, yeah, this was really boring. And the crowd like within the first minute, you can hear boring chants.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They're pretty merciless at MSG at this point in time with the boring chants. I've noticed that watching the previous shows. It was something like you didn't hear earlier in the 80s. But now, by 85, they will turn on a match, you know, immediately. And with good reason for this one, because nothing was going on. Fulton, he has nothing interesting to do when he's in control. And Lord Al with the biggest bullshit line of the night when he said this could be a main event in Europe and London. maybe the wrestling scene at that time was pretty bad. Well, I know World of Sport had seen better days in 1985.
There you go.
Jesus Christ. The pin led to a big pop from the crowd, but that was like
the only because it was over.
Right.
it was over, and it was the only offensive move of the whole night. I mean, the sunset flip in 1985 is like one of the most over moves in wrestling, though. Really,
yes.
He did nail it. Throughout my run on Titans, I never gave star ratings, but I thought in honor of your show, I would debut star ratings, and I thought now that I'm, you know, done with Titans, I'll start a new chapter in my life.
Nice.
And start rating matches. And fittingly enough, the first match I attempt to give a star rating to gets 0 stars. This is a dud for me.
Yeah. I feel like if there's any pop at all on these shows in any level, and maybe you're more grizzled with the MSG stuff than I am, but I tend to give, like, okay, they got a little pop and they, you know, the end was okay, so I give them the little half a star there. But this was on the path for a dud if it had a worse ending.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, JR. They seem to have tried to. The ending's fine. At first, I wasn't crazy about it, but as I was, you know, watching the show and thinking about it, I'm like, you know, the ending was actually pretty cool for Roma. But as we're talking, I mean, the path to get there. Let's spend, you know, 10 minutes and 15 seconds in headlocks and
this could maybe use like spot. You know, like at least he varies his offense and is a little more fluid with the offense in his control segments. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it went great, but it probably wouldn't have been as boring with Spot in place of Fulton.
And Charlie Fulton's not a bad
wrestler.
Yeah.
You know, he's not a bad wrestler. So, all right, 10:45. Any last thoughts, Kelly?
No, let's move on, please.
No, I'm not giving stars. I'm not giving comments. see my words. So there you go. So Paul Roma gets the win. Over Charlie Fulton, 78.
No one has
Charlie
ever
Fulton.
In history spent more time in that match than we just did right there. Guaranteed.
The length of time talking about it was longer than the match. All right, next up, a couple of good, couple of solid workers here, in my opinion, and I think you would agree. I'm curious Kelly's take on one of these guys. JR, who do we have?
We do have Lanny Poffo, who now we've seen a few times here at MSG, battling...
Not Lanny Poffo.
Battling Iron Mike Sharp, the old veteran, making his debut for us. Coming from a wrestling family, Mike Sharp made his pro debut in 1977 in Calgary, home of Kelly Nelson, original home, hometown. Remained in Calgary, in Canada, until joined JDF in early 83, along with his trademark black forearm brace, received a considerable push upon debuting, but by 1984, relegated to lower mid-card, eventually jobber status, and remains in this role until 1995. So we'll be seeing plenty of him. Also ran a training school out of Jersey. So again, I don't call it a debut because he's new for us, but he's been around. Kelly, how much Sharp have you watched on your Titans days? And you know, was he a guy that before he was pushed to the status had any kind of chance to do anything else?
For me, I've told this story on Mystery Titans Theater, one of our offshoots, the YouTube show we did where we did commentary over shows, and we got into like shows from 85, 86, and 87 where Sharp's all over them. And this brought back horrible memories of my childhood, because I got into wrestling in 1986. And this guy was on TV, and he was being promoted as Canada's greatest athlete. And it was embarrassing. I mean, I was only 8, 9 years old, but this was the best Canadian wrestler there was. It was just heartbreaking for me that this was the guy that was presented on TV as being Canada's greatest athlete. So I've always hated him because of that. I mean, you know, not based on his, you know, as a worker or as a person or anything, just that memory of being embarrassed that this was Canada's greatest athlete. And then being on the Mystery Titan shows, he was often in some pretty bad matches, and it kind of became a running joke whenever he came on. I would groan and all that. I'll give it to him. He hung on for a long time. And I was interested in getting into 1983 for Titans because that's when he first debuts, and he's actually managed by, I think, Lou Albano.
Yeah.
And given a push, and he actually has a match with Backlund for the heavyweight title at the Spectrum in 1983. So I was kind of intrigued to see that because, you know, otherwise all we know of Mike Sharp is as, well, his role tonight and in the future. So
right, just like, but slightly like a hair above true jobber status, a name jobber, you know.
Yeah totally. He never won on TV, but at least he had a gimmick and a character, right. But yeah, screw Mike Sharp.
All right, well. So here we go. Lanny's back after his month off, set to battle Canada's greatest athlete, veteran Mike Sharp. Gorilla mocks the self-proclaimed moniker, and the crowd didn't really seem to care for it either as they boo it. Sharp stalls for a bit as Poffo tries to come at him, and they finally make contact. Lanny sends Sharp all over the place with a flurry. Sharp bails to the floor to regroup as Poffo backflips around in the ring to a big pop. Sharp comes back in and lands a couple of shots, but whiffs on a dropkick and then eats three of them from Lanny, which again sends Sharp flopping to the floor as Poffo flips around yet again in celebration. Alfred puts over how Lanny strikes three times with all his moves and performances. Three dropkicks, three backflips, comes in threes. Sharp slowly climbs back in the ring while bitching and then offers a handshake to Poffo, and he tries a sandbag, but Lanny was ready to slugs him. Sharp resets again and is able to grab a side headlock, but Lanny works free. Sharp maintains control through a test of strength, but Lanny monkey flips out of it and dropkicks Sharp in the head. And again, Iron Mike goes scurrying to the floor. Sharp comes back and lands a sucker punch to level Lanny and starts to chop away and land a few more blows to the head. Poffo quickly punches and kicks his way back into the match, leading to Sharp getting twisted in the ropes. Poffo lands a few shots in before Sharp fights free. The two trade some heavy strikes from there until Sharp drops Lanny with a hard right to the gut. Lanny recovers and gets a couple of near falls off cradles before hitting a big splash off the middle rope for two. Poffo follows that with a somersault senton off the top rope for two. Of course, not called that. Chokes Sharp out of frustration. Poffo heads outside, tries a springboard big splash, but eats Sharp's knees. Poffo dodges an attack and comes back to level Sharp with a dropkick. Sharp starts to unlace his forearm pad, but Poffo rolls him up for two. Sharp goes to the eyes and then chokes Poffo with the rawhide until he unraveled before. Sharp lays in more blows but misses a charge to the corner, allowing Poffo to choke him with the rawhide. And the two trade momentum until Sharp misses a forearm and Poffo kicks him in the face and then chokes away and goes at the eyes and bites, which shocks Gorilla for the way he's acting. Sharp drops down and pulls Lanny outside, but Lanny's able to run him into the post as the bell rings for a time limit draw at 20 minutes. This was, I thought, surprisingly good for such a long back and forth. They paced it pretty well for the 20 minutes. There's really no rest spots in there. Sharp kept right up with Lanny. He brought a lot of energy. I think Lanny should have won, but both guys kind of looked good in the end. It was hard fought. They executed. I went a star and a half because I enjoyed it. I could have went with maybe like 5 minutes shorter and just a Lanny win. And there were many times here where I was just waiting for the finish. And, you know, by like the sixth time, I realized what was happening, that we weren't getting one. So, again, on a night where we'll see where there's not much to brag about, this ends up looking pretty good. but I think they could have shortened it a bit and not done the draw. What'd you think, Kelly?
I mean, Poffo should have went over as far as like the crowd reactions he's been getting, but I guess you can see, you know, they didn't have, even at this early stage of his career in WWF, they didn't have any plans for him beyond, you know, jobber to the star status. But yeah, I was pleasantly surprised with this match because I knew the result beforehand, so I saw it was going to be a 20-minute draw, so I wasn't exactly, you know, salivating with anticipation getting to watch this, but it turned out to be pretty good because Poffo was very good with his hope spots and his offense. There was heat throughout, no boring chance, no downtime, really.
Like you mentioned,
20 minute draw, no rest holds. There's always something going on. Sharp, you know, I'll give him some credit. He was always doing something heelish. He just nonstop heel. Like that's he's such a typical heel, like in a way that that just doesn't exist anymore. Like everything he does is some sort of underhanded, dirty tactic or some sort of cheating.
And they use the stalling in place of the rest holds. I mean that, but like you said, to his credit, he was always sneering and yelling at the face. You know, he was always doing something evil during that time. But that's kind of what they did to take the breaks here and there. But once it got cooking, they really didn't even do that much.
That's true. And the crowd was into hating him. They were chanting wimp at Sharp throughout. And Poffel got fired up at the end, and it started to get a little heated. And it spilled to the outside, and it looked like, okay, who knows what's going to happen. And then the bell rang. So, considering the placement on the card and sort of the status of these two guys, I thought this was a perfectly fine match.
What do you think, Scott?
Two stars. I'm not used to saying that at the end of my reviews.
There you go.
Two stars.
We didn't for how many years, Scott? 6 years.
I know. Yeah, we did.
5.5 years. Yeah. So it's new here as well. So we'll learn together.
I Kelly was going to take a half star away from you because I knew you wouldn't give this much credit. I didn't think you'd give this much credit to Iron Mike Sharp, but I'm also giving it 2 stars. I think they told a great story. I think they really did. I'm really enjoying I'm not sure, Kelly, but. I trashed Mean Gene when he did commentary with Gorilla. I just thought he was terrible. He was so sugary and just all that baby face announcing all at once. I just thought it was too much at times. I'm really enjoying Alfred in this spot because he's just so subtle. Like I don't think Alfred gets enough credit for his ability to put things over in a very subtle way. And at one point, it made me laugh. He said when they talked about Canada's greatest athlete, of course, you know, Gorilla thought it was all poppycock, and Alfred goes, well, after Wayne Gretzky, I think maybe he might possibly be Canada's greatest athlete. And I'm like, I mean, I just love how he was so subtle with the way he said things to disagree with Gorilla without him being like, you know, combative or whatever. Work in this match. I mean, this match is definitely better than the first one. It was still a little plodding, but I give Iron Mike Sharp credit. He knows how to he's a little different than Charlie Fulton. He kind of, you know, dictated things, and Lanny Poffo's no rookie. So I kind of enjoy that they kind of understood how to get through this draw without being dreadfully boring. If this was the first match, I think we would have killed ourselves or the crowd. I agree with you, JR. I'm curious what you think. I agree with you too, Kelly, that I don't think this needed to be a draw per se. Like you said, JR, you probably could have cut 5 minutes and moved on. So I think that might be the only thing that kills this match is it probably could have gone 15 or 13. I think we'd have been okay.
Yeah.
So that's what I say. So a 20-minute draw between Leap and Lanny and Iron Mike Sharp. I don't remember. He didn't do any – did he do any frisbees?
I don't think he's doing it yet. Yeah.
No, he doesn't have the gimmick or the poetry either.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
He's just a guy who does a lot of flips.
little flips, flip flopping flies. I'm getting confused with when we're doing the network adventure, I'm into 86 the prime times. He's doing the men. So,
okay. Yeah.
All right. Next up, what is this? Like the fifth fifth house show this year that we see this guy, and he's acting the same. And I still don't understand how Gorilla's Bobby's his manager. But who do we got, JR?
I've kind of liked the missing link. And here he's actually fighting. Believe it or not, the first time we're seeing him is Tony Garea, who's been around forever, but we haven't seen him yet here in 1985. Began his pro career in his native New Zealand in 1971. Made his way to San Francisco. Became co-holder of the tag titles of Pat Patterson. 1972 signed on with the WWWF. Would win the tag team titles on 5 separate occasions with 4 different partners. In 1982, began working singles, became a fairly prolific jobber to the stars, remains in that role till 1986, and of course, would take on a road agent, which he still does today, believe it or not. Kelly, before we get to the match, any thoughts on Tony from the footage you've watched?
I mean, he was a guy before we started Titans that I didn't really have much of an opinion on. The 5 tag reigns, and one of my favorite tapes as a kid was the tag team history tape, and I watched it a million times. But of course, I was more a fan of like Rick Martel, for example, in that tag. Yes, and not just because he's Canadian, but so Gurria was kind of another kind of just faceless dude. But I mean, you know, Johnny kind of won me over because Johnny has like an undying love for Tony Gurria, who was his first favorite wrestler, I think. And we saw a damn lot of Tony over the years, and He's not, you know, I wouldn't put him up on any kind of list as anything special, but I mean, he was solid and he hung around for a long time and was definitely respected. And his team with Rick Martel was actually really good. They produced several really, really good to great matches with all kinds of different teams too. So, but by this time it's the long decline of Tony Garea. Long that still goes on into 1986. Poor guy.
I just want to correct JR. I don't know if it was maybe it was Jeff that thought it, but this is not our first Tony Garea. No, back in June 21st house show, he lost to
Bundy. That's right,
Bundy. Yep. Yeah.
That's right. I used because I remember I kept saying that that end of that match, the avalanche he gives him was used in the original Primetime Wrestling opens.
Oh, there we go.
So
okay.
So there we go.
Well, I read his background again.
You knew who was going to bring that up, and I was not going to allow that. So there you go. So previous appearance for. But you know what? Tony Garea deserves the respect to have a second intro, so that's fine.
Yes. The and Kelly, so the Martel. Marty Slee is always getting so excited at the wee-wee Ricky Martel when he made the hot tag is one of my favorites from tag teams back again.
Oh, yeah, I know. He got that over pretty well.
He loved it. Especially the episode there. And if anyone, again, not to put you over too much, but the tag teams back again episode on, or I think it was two episodes on the Strike Force Islanders stuff was fantastic. I love that. Yep.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite shows too, those two. Yeah.
A lot of fun. All right, so here we are. Missing Link and Bobby Heenan are back this month. Link continues to wreck his way through the roster, stomping to the ring as Heenan tries to track him down. Alfred says Garea's had nightmares about this match last night, and here we are. Link goes right at Garea with headbutts, and Tony sustains them and comes firing back with punches and a knee to the head. Garea snaps Link's arm across the top rope and then runs into the buckles. Link tries to escape, but Garea yanks him back into the ring by the arm. Garea keeps working the arm, but Link uses some leverage and shoves Tony hard to the floor. Garea comes back and starts to attack the leg, kicking him in the quad over and over until he finally collapses. Link shoots Garea to the corner, but Garea dodges a charge and gets a roll-up for two, followed by a small package for two, and a high-cross body for two as well. Link is rattled, but Garea drops his head, and Link hammers him with a clubbing blow. Link then hits the springboard headbutt and gets the win. I thought this was really good booking. I thought it was cool that Link got caught off guard for the first time. He really gets stunned by that Garea flurry, and it was like the crowd really got into that little flurry there. I thought Garea worked a nice game plan, and then he makes that one mistake, and as soon as he does it, like Gorilla and Alfred are all over, like, oh, no. And then it's almost like he got way ahead of himself and kind of lost track of what he was doing. I thought it was good psychology. The crowd bought in. I thought it's the best Link match we've seen so far. But I say that not to trash his other matches, but it's been the natural progression of Link's matches where he's kind of fought bum, and now he's like working his way up a little bit, and he gets someone that's more capable of delivering a little bit more offense and piecing together a match. And I went half a star on this just because I like the psychology, and I love that little Garea flurry at the end where he almost picked up the pin a few times. What'd you think, Scott?
Yeah, it was unique for Link to get a little frazzled because usually it's a pretty straightforward thing for him. And, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed kind of the interesting dynamic they had, where Garea, you know, he's finally facing, cause so far we've seen him face like some real, you know, young stiffs, and now he's facing kind of an experienced worker who's probably not the first crazy guy he's faced in the ring. So he worked with it. And I kind of like the psychology. I give it a star for the 4-minute effort that it got. 4:09 was the official time. I'm going to give it a star for the work that was put into the psychology of such a short sprint. Kelly, what do you think?
Yeah, well, Garea had sort of perfected this role by this time. This is what he'd been doing for like the last 2-3 years was the gatekeeper and the guy who would, you know, have a competitive little match with a guy that they were pushing. There's a million different examples of Garea doing this type of match. I don't know. I mean, Missing Link is someone I've never really got into. I haven't seen a ton of him, and I too am like surprised that he's had this many MSG matches.
It shocked me. I did not think we were gonna see this much of him. Like,
no.
And he's in next month too, not to get too ahead, but he's still around.
I think he was kind of, when he was first brought in, they had an idea that he would be a future Hogan opponent. And didn't Heenan, like when he introduced him the first time, said this will be the man to end Hogan's title run.
That, and he was brought in kind of to take out Orndorff at first as well, because he comes in right when Orndorff turns on Bobby. And they do that stuff on TNT. I just watched that where Bobby, they go to the cave and he's roasting his meat or whatever. He's turning the meat.
Yeah, no, they had plans. They had bigger plans, but I think, unfortunately, backstage, Missing Link was such a mess drug-wise that he just was so unreliable and they couldn't trust him to do anything. But they definitely had plans for him.
I think putting him with Bobby is proof of that. You know what I mean? Like, I don't...
Yeah, that's another... That's a big rub, putting him with Heenan. And he's a fellow Canadian. He's Dewey Robinson, someone who wrestled in the old Toronto, well, not really territory, but wrestled in Toronto for years and years and was a headliner there. He was quite old by this point. He was well into his 40s, I think, and actually wouldn't work too much afterwards, I don't think. As for the match, yeah, I give it a half star. It was, It did what it had to do to get Link more over. And Gurria, that's his role. But, yeah, nothing really got me too terribly excited throughout.
And we'll see what they continue to do with Link as well as we move along. You know, at some point he's going to get something more than this, but we'll see. This was at least a step forward from what he's been doing.
He's going to have to – yeah, he's going to have to somehow – we're going to have to see some – legit competition here. I mean, for work rate purposes, and I think JR would really love it. I think if we had a Missing Link George Animal Steel match, I think it would be a main event anywhere in the world.
All right, next match.
Anywhere in the world.
In my fucking toilet. That's the only place.
Yeah. All right, next up, speaking of toilet.
Toilet that big Al shit on instead of in this afternoon, or this evening, I should say, by the way. We're working a little bit on potty training. And he was sitting there. My daughter's reading to him. And then he gets up and gets on the stool and shits there instead. So it got all over the stool in the front of the toilet. Yeah. Like, what's the point of that? Like, just go in the fucking toilet. Anyway, sorry. That's what I thought of when you told me about a George Steele Missing Link match, by the way.
He dropped a George Steele.
That's the correlation I made. And by the way, rest in peace, George Steele. I make these jokes, Justin. Yeah. Of course, legend in the business, very successful. I like to joke on him because it just, at this point that we're watching, he's just what he is. But obviously very sad news when he, along with Ivan Koloff, passed away this past week.
Yeah, it's been a rough week for the legends. And all I can say about Steele is, yeah, I was never a fan, really. I mean, he was very important in the whole Savage Elizabeth dynamic. You know, he got that over. But I have gone back and I've watched a lot of stuff of Steele's. Well, not a lot, but he pops up all the time in the 70s on MSG cards. And he was actually really good as a lunatic, deranged lunatic.
Right.
Heel in that role. I would recommend checking. Oh, and there's a match they just put up on the network, the cage match with Bruno from 1970. That's pretty good.
And that's what I've always suspected was that. Obviously, I mean, to have the name and the legacy he had, he must have been pretty good at some point. Like, to your point, Kelly, I just haven't seen it, so it's on me to go back and watch some of it. The Steel we're seeing now is, and I'm not looking forward to it. Scott, we chronicled it in our Saturday Night's Main Event ebook when we watched all of them. I mean, they fight like 7 times on Saturday's Main Event. Like, him and Savage, just enough. But
it was a never-ending feud.
I thought he was really funny on the TNT. I just watched the one with the electroshock therapy. I actually thought he was really funny in that segment.
Oh, no, brown cow.
It's delivery.
That swank leisure suit or whatever that thing he had. You know? All right. Anyway, let's go from leisure
that
suit
match
to
will still be
who...
dog shit, regardless of his legacy. But anyway.
Let's talk about a guy who's been wrestling like dog shit and is a former WWF champion, because I don't know what's happened in this stretch, Kelly, but... former WWF champion here against another iconic jobber. What do we got here?
We got Barrio battling Pedro Morales. And Parv let us in on the dirty secret that Pedro Morales has always sucked. do you agree with the hot take, Kelly, that Pedro was actually never any good?
Well, the 1980s Pedro, yes. Definitely. Yeah.
He didn't seem to be a fan of even pre-80s
Morales. Oh, no, Morales, Parv hates Pedro Morales. The flying pig is what he calls it.
Oh, boy. All right, let's talk about the match, and then you can give us your take on the match and Pedro, Kelly. Big hearty welcome for Pedro here as Alpha tries to mimic Fink's R rolling, which I thought was really funny when he just kept failing on him. Morales! Barry shoves Pedro back during the instructions, triggering a heart flurry that sends Barry to the floor. The match resets with some stalling until Barry grabs a side headlock, but Pedro works it into a hammerlock. Barry fights out and clobbers Pedro to knock him to the mat, and then goes to a chinlock. Morales fights to his feet, but Barry slung him hard through the ropes into the floor in a nice bump. Barry keeps the pressure on when Pedro rolls back in, stomping and choking away. The crowd busted out a loud Pedro chant here, but Barry just mocks it and continues to hammer away at him. Pedro launches into a comeback, filled with left hands that floored Barry. Pedro follows with a backdrop and a nice high-angle backbreaker for the win. Barry attacks after the bell, but Pedro runs him off. And I thought this was quick and to the point. I thought it's the best Pedro's looked of these few we've seen, Scott. It didn't amble on. It featured a couple of nice big bumps. Barry was really good at playing to the crowd. I like when they mock the chant. And it's fine for this slot on the card. Again, a match that maybe would, you know, not be as offensive if it was on a card with better surroundings, but here it just feels like another fucking assembly line terrible match. I went half a star just because I liked Barry playing to the crowd and I liked the finish. Kelly, what did you think of the match, and then just your thoughts on Pedro?
Well, it was short, so that was a plus in Pedro's favor, because usually what happens with him is there'll be a 10-minute long chin lock or a front face lock, even worse, spot with him, and it just grinds everything to a crawl. So this was quick. Pedro can still take pretty good bumps. Like the over the top bump was huge, actually. Like, as good as anybody could do at that time, really. So that was a point in his favor. Of course, we get the huge Pedro comeback. Like, every Pedro match is almost the same. It's you know, I think Hogan almost copied Pedro's act later in his career, where it was just, you know, hot start, sell for 80% of the match, and then have a hot comeback.
Right.
But, of course, Hogan's were much more interesting. And then he busted out a Billy Robinson backbreaker, which I hadn't seen, or I don't think I'd seen Pedro use before. That's a very cool visual move. I've always loved it. So that's another point. So I ended up with 1 star for this match. Yeah. And further thoughts on Pedro? I mean, the guy in the 70s was a big enough star to be Bruno's replacement, so he was obviously big time. We have nothing to go on. Like, he started in the early 60s, so there's a whole decade lost. Most of the 70s isn't available footage-wise, so, you know, I'm sure we missed out on some pretty awesome Pedro matches. And he was a legend. He was a big star. He held the belt for almost 3 years straight. So that's pretty good.
Parv said even if you had the matches, it'd be a lost decade. so it doesn't matter. yeah, I mean, this was a good sprint. Nothing crazy, and it is the best that Pedro's looked. But, I mean, it's been obvious that he's been off for a while. And, I mean, they made a big deal, JR, when we had him on immediately, you know, when we had his first match a few months back. And he obviously was rusty. Parv will tell you he's been rusty since 1962, but I mean, now I feel like he's maybe getting his boots under him a little bit. I thought it was fine. I give it a star. I mean, it was fine. It served its purpose. Crowd was not totally into it, but at 5:00, what's our official time? 5:02. It was fine. It was what it was. It felt shorter. You know what's weird? It felt shorter than the Link Gurria match, and that match was a minute shorter, but this match felt shorter. I don't know why, but anyway, I mean, it is what it is. Pedro Morales gets a nice, you know, mid-card win, and Barry O does what he does best. So there we go. We don't have to talk much more about it, so Parv will actually listen to this show. All right, now we go to a guy. Now our next match, JR just wants to leave the room.
Actually, I may surprise you with my takes on this one.
Well, I think it's a one-sided take, in my opinion. But go ahead.
All right. So we have our Big John Studd match here tonight, taking on, yes, Uncle Elmer, brought in by Hillbilly Jim for revenge on behalf of him and his battles. Of course, Hillbilly's leg was broken a few months back, and here we are. Jeff actually overlooked this, which I'm okay with. Didn't give much of a background on Elmer. Kelly, is there any background you want to provide us on Uncle Elmer before we get started?
Well, he was known as Plowboy Fraser down south. Wrestled a lot in Memphis. Wrestled in Georgia. Was pretty much the same slow-moving slug as he is in 1985.
Slow-moving slug. Yeah. Tremendous.
So, Yeah,
he was a heel in Memphis. That I know. He was a heel because watching the set that Wills made for us. He was a heel because he was a big Jimmy Hart. I think he was, you know, one
That's
of the
right.
67 guys Jimmy Hart's family, first family. I think every heel in the company was in Jimmy Hart's first family. He was like the only manager. So when he was Plowboy, actually he was Playboy Frazier because JR. When you think of Uncle Elmer, you think Playboy.
I think of Elmer's glue, which is how fucking slow he was.
So anyway, that's one thing. That's the only other time I've seen him outside of WWF too. Kelly is some of the Memphis stuff I saw in like.
It's such an awful name too, Elmer. Like it just makes fucking
Elmer.
Everything about him should be on fucking Hee Haw.
Well, thank God, Cousin Junior was 3,000 miles away.
Oh, he's even worse.
Trifecta of disgust.
At least Elmer had like some fucking background. Junior's a. Being a hillbilly is like a strike already, and then being the scrub of the hillbillies is even like that's even worse. I hate Cousin Junior. God, I hate him.
God,
it was the one tape I continuously avoided over the years. Was the Hillbillies Coliseum tape?
Oh God, why did they make a Hillbillies collection? It's like making a tape of. It's like making a tape of midgets.
They loved him. Oh. Vince loved them. Oh, he loves them. And we're going to be
Vince. Well, they were over. I mean, the crowd did love them.
Hillbillies
I mean.
And midgets. Oh, God.
We're going to be talking a lot about these hillbillies, too, Scott, coming up. I mean, this is...
I know. Yes. Yes, we do.
You're just starting, really.
Yeah. Oh, God. All right. So good heat for Stud. Huge pop for the hillbillies here. They march to the ring, glad-handing the fans. Stud jumps on Elmer as he's getting prepped and lays in some kicks and knees as Elmer rolls around like a whale on the ground. Jim tries to fire up Elmer as Stud keeps laying the wood. Elmer finally bows up and starts landing some heavy punches that drive Stud across the ring to the other corner. Elmer shoots Stud across and smashes him with a running splash and then rallies up the hot crowd. Elmer tries to slam Stud, but Heenan comes in and clobbers him from behind. Hillbilly comes in and grabs Heenan, but Stud makes the save. Elmer then saves Hillbilly and chokes and slugs away at Heenan. And MSG is just fucking going bananas here. Stud and Heenan finally escape as the Hillbillies shake hands and dance in a hoedown to celebrate. This is a fun little hoss match. They had some big blows. The crowd is just maniacal. I mean, they're just so into this, and the finish is so red hot. The actual action was nothing, but I gave it a half a star because I liked the energy and the heat like of everything. As much as I despise that fat fuck and his nonsense and the overalls and all of it, there was a little bit of hillbilly magic going on at MSG that night. What do you think?
I don't think we'll ever hear anything like Uncle Elmer bowed up. Yeah, that actually happened.
He did. He bowed right up in the corner and came right at him.
All right. Here are all of the nicknames that Stanley C. Frazier ever had in his business. Oh, he was A-Team Number 2, Big Tex, Ed Younger, Congorilla, Cowboy Frazier, Farmer Boy Frazier, Giant Frazier, Giant Hillbilly, Hillbilly Elmer. That would have been better. He was Kamala too at one point. Pascagoula. Could you imagine him with moonstuff painted on him? Pascagoula Plowboy. Playboy Frazier. Plowboy Frazier. Tex Frazier. The Convict. The Country Plowboy. The Giant Rebel. Tiny Frazier. Tiny the Plowboy. The Lone Ranger. Uncle Elmer. And Lieutenant Frazier. There you go.
I would argue that Plowboy Frazier is Plowboy Frazier is actually. No, wait. Was it Plowboy what?
There was the giant. There was the Country Plowboy.
That sounds plowboy. Worse than Playboy Frazier. The Country Plowboy. I mean, that sounds more like a genre porn right there than anything else. Oh, the Country Plowboy's in town.
Oh God. I think this match is totally carried by Stud's heel work. I think the crowd is just pumped because they hate Stud so much and Bobby. But I just, I mean, it's just, and then they do that fucking hoedown shit after the match where they're stooging around and doing that stupid dance. Oh, it's dreadful. I love Stud. I'm a big Stud guy. But I felt bad for him that he had to sit and deal with this bullshit. So bad. I'm sorry. I'm giving it a dud. I'm not liking it at all. I think it was crap. Kelly, what do you think?
Well, I mean, it was super heated and it was only a couple minutes long. It did what it had to do. I mean, Hillbilly, I guess, was still hurt at this point, so he couldn't wrestle.
2:40 official time. 2:40.
Yeah, it was super quick. They were building for the future because Hillbilly was still going to be feuding with the Heenan family going forward. So you know, it was quite short. And if I'd ever rented that Hillbillies tape, I would have been able to see this match because it was on that tape. Well, I finally got to see it. But yeah, I only went a half star as well on this one.
Yep, the official name of that tape was Wrestling's Country Boys.
Wrestling's fucking pile of shit.
Green cover, I can still.
Tiny Frazier.
Oh god.
That was one of the names, right? Tiny Frazier.
Tiny Frazier.
Yeah, yep. There you go.
There's like five Frasers, like six Playboys, five Plowboys.
I guess he was a tiny dancer, right? They do the hoedown in the ring. There you go.
The Country Plowboy.
Oh god.
It sounds like a fucking restaurant. I'm gonna really? Grab me some grits at the Country Plowboy.
That sounds a lot worse than that. Oh boy. It's like, honey, get the door. You know, instead of the pizza delivery guy, who's here? Oh, it's the Country Plowboy has arrived.
There was Tiny the Plowboy. That's even better. Pull me closer, Tiny Plowboy.
I want to hear Johnny Cyro do his strip club DJ voice to call Country Plowboy to the stage.
Ladies and gentlemen, here is...
calling Country Plowboy to the stage.
I can hear it already.
Oh, God. Oh, terrible. All right. Anyway, all right, let's move on from this. All right, our next match...
Poor John Studd.
Yeah, definitely poor John Studd. There's no doubt about that. Next up, a guy that I remember seeing. I mean, I used to see his name in like print in the mags and stuff. And then JR. Pull me closer, Country Plowboy. Out your clothes.
Hold him on the carriage.
You gotta find him on the wrestling album. Mumbles his way through that too.
That would have been the heel turn for the family, and they go to like all deliverance on the baby faces.
Bring him over to the Country Plowboy. I'll teach this boy a lesson.
We'll set him straight. All right. This guy, JR, in this match coming up, I remember seeing him like in the mags and everything. And then he was on an episode of TNT.
The mags.
And the mags. And then he was on an episode of TNT. And I was like, oh, this guy's kind of cool. And I don't remember really seeing any matches. But he makes his MSG debut here, or our MSG debut here, taking on a guy that we are more than familiar with. JR, yes. What do we have?
Tony Atlas, Mr. Junior USA, Junior Mr. Universe, I should say. Tony Atlas.
Yes.
Taking on Les Thornton, born in Manchester, England in April of 1934. Began his wrestling career in 1957. Oh, that is an old gentleman right there, of course. I mean, that's before World War II this guy was born. That is ancient. Began his wrestling career in 1957, competed in various promotions across Japan, Europe, and North America in the 70s and 80s, including Stampede, WWF, and the NWA territories. At one point in his career, Thornton considered to be one of the best junior heavyweights in the world. Simultaneously held the WWF and NWA World Junior Heavyweight titles, held the NWA Junior title 5 times. Here in his mid-80s run, Thornton used mainly as a jobber. At the end of his career, formed his own promotion in Calgary called the Canadian Independent Wrestling Federation. Any knowledge of that promotion?
I don't recall that promotion at all. What year was that? Any idea?
No, he didn't put in here, Jeff. This is at the end of his run. So it's got maybe the late 80s, early 90s, I'm guessing. I mean, I'm not sure when he wrapped up.
Wow.
No. Little fun fact.
So he'd have been 51. In this match, then.
There you go.
He didn't look it, though.
No, he didn't. And the,
fun fact?
Oh, my personal fun fact is I always mixed him up with Les Thatcher.
Me too.
I think that was an easy slip up.
Always. So whenever I'd see like Les Thatcher's name like in the early 2000s, I'd just mix him up with what I've known of Les Thornton. Like I just always got them confused, the two of them. Like because you know, when he was just getting going with OVW and all that stuff, you'd see his name in the rudimentary online world of wrestling. Thatcher popped up a lot, and I'd get him confused. Yeah, it was, you know, they seemed to like, because I always had read that Thornton was like the junior heavyweight champion, and then I'd see Thatcher, I'd be like, this fucking guy was like one of the best juniors in the world. Like this, it doesn't seem right. But here we are. Tony Atlas, shredded body, return this month, taking a Les Thornton, who I put here, takes a break from filming Police Academy because I thought he looked like the fucking, who's the guy?
Which one? The little scrawny guy, right?
Yeah, the little guy with the black hair and the I should have wrote his name down. Anyway,
the skinny guy. I'll look it up. Go ahead.
The nerdy guy with the glasses. Yeah, Thorne gets in Atlas's face as he climbs the steps, but the ref backs him off. Atlas grabs a side headlock off the bell as Alfred puts Thornton in the top best active wrestlers from England right now, he says. Thornton tries to turn the headlock into a roll-up, but Atlas maintains control. By the way, Alfred goes on for like 3 minutes trying to whittle down whether Thornton's the best of all time, the best now. Like, he's in his top five all time, maybe top three. And you know what? I think he's actually the best right now. Like, he goes through it like he's just conversing with himself completely for this whole conversation. So Thornton tries to turn the headlock into a roll-up. Atlas maintains control. Gorilla again brings up Junior Mr. Universe as Tony works into a hammerlock. Thornton works out of the hole. They go into a little crisscross with leapfrogs until Tony grabs an armbar and an arm drag and turns it to an arm wringer. Thornton fights to his feet and tries to punch free, but Atlas keeps the hold hooked on tight. Thornton finally breaks out of the hold and twists into control, taking Tony down and grabbing a chin lock. Thornton releases and keeps in charge with some basic heel offense, raking the eyes and landing uppercuts and a tight knee drop before going back to the chin lock. Tony fights to his feet and punches free, but Thornton kicks back and dives for the chin lock, but Atlas sneaks out and goes to a hammerlock. Tony rams Thornton into the corner as Gorilla mentions Tony's ambitions are to find a partner and go after the tag titles, naming George Wells as a choice. Not much casual racism there at all. Who's the only other black guy in the promotion? Oh, George Wells. They'll team up nicely. Thornton tries to run.
Bad eye.
Right? I know. He can't even go right now. So, God forbid, he can't look at anyone else as a tag partner. He's going to wait for George Wells to heal up. Thornton tries to run Tony's head to the buckle, but of course, more racism as that backfires. Atlas stalks him to the corner, but Les lands a shot to the gut and knees him to the floor. Les meets Atlas at the ropes with a hard forearm and punches him, and then heads out and runs Atlas hard to the post. Back inside, Thornton misses a charge in the corner, and Atlas hits the big press slam and splash for the win. I thought this was bland overall. The guys had sharp execution when they hit, both on the mat and with the strikes, and the last minute was good, but otherwise, again, just didn't really get on track. It just never really clicked. Atlas picks up another win, starts to eye some gold. I went only a star here, and I was kind of disappointed because I thought Atlas has been better than we've expected the couple times we've seen him, and I expected more from Thornton, and they just never really seem to get on the same page. What'd you think, Kelly?
Yeah, I think you're right. This was a styles clash, totally. I remember Les Thornton from Calgary. It would have been, I guess, the next year, 1986, when I first started watching Stampede. He was there. I don't know why I remember him of all the guys, but I definitely remember Les Thornton. I mean, he's well regarded from his 70s work, which is, you know, he's another guy that I don't think there's much out there to judge him on, but he has a good reputation with the veteran wrestlers, that's for sure. Tony Ellis, I've seen a lot of course, on Titans. He's up and down, and this at this point, I think he was pretty down, pretty bad with drug abuse. And you can kind of tell, like, after the match, he just walks out of the ring and leaves, like, with no fanfare at all. And the crowd turned on this one quick, too. There was a lot of boring chants. This was a flashback to the opener for me, basically. And I gave it the same rating. I gave it a dud. I didn't like it at all.
Sweet Chuck was the yes. Police Academy guy in that.
Yep, Carl. I was about to say, Carl Sweet Chuck.
There you go. I thought
Sweet Chuck on roids. yeah, that was I kind of veiled. I was thinking, you know, maybe he'd say, oh, Tony Atlas, let's find some good tag partners for him. Let's see, SD Joe,
right,
Rocky Johnson. this match isn't much. Tony Atlas is just not a good wrestler. He's just not. I mean, he's a great physique, $1 million body, but I mean, about 10 cents worth of wrestling ability.
And a lot of painting ability.
And incredible painting ability. But of course, according to Paul Orndorff, he looks like Willie B at the Atlanta Zoo. Paul Orndorff would not have been happy with these tag teams.
He would not.
But
Orndorff, oh my lord.
This match is nothing much, and Tony Atlas just, I like the guy. He's a nice, you know, he seems like a nice enough guy, but he just doesn't have a lot of. And he said it himself in the Legends of Wrestling series on the network that he peaked really early when him and Rocky Johnson were tag team champions. And from that point on, it just, he was just kind of filling gaps.
Yeah.
On these house shows. It's not like, I mean, for a guy like that, and Vince loved guys, you know, big jacked up dudes. You would have thought Vince would have loved this guy, but I think Vince knew there really wasn't much there elsewhere.
His rep for the drug issues was really bad and just wasn't, because they would never give him an angle or anything, and he'd still be there for years, right? But you would never see him part of a program or a feud with anybody. He would just have these aimless matches,
right? You
know, for years and years. Yeah.
Yep. So, all right. So there's Tony Atlas gets the win. Your length of that match was 11:32. Oh my God. 11:32 of that. All right. So, let's see. Why don't we
go back to the academy with Sweet Chuck? Yeah. Let's take a break here.
Go to Sweet Chuck. Why don't we take a break? When we come back, we'll have some interviews, and then we have, let's see, we got one, two, three matches left, but two really big ones.
Yeah.
And we get a couple of announcement matches, JR, for our next vault. So plenty more to come. Myself, JR, Mr. Nelson. But first, many words from many countries. Because the last time I checked it, thank God I'm blessed with the mind that'll wreck it. Waited till the second round and knock him out. They call me Big John Studd, my middle name Mud. Dirty water flow, too much for you thug. That can't stand the flood. What up, Doc? Whole big like Elmer Fudd. The show, I miss a map, I'm unplugged. Learn, temperature's too hot for some. Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, Place to Be Nation Pop feed, Pro Wrestling Only feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place of the Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Gary Michael Capetta, and this is the Place to Be podcast with Scott Riscola and Justin Rosero.
Show, show, let it all out.
All right, Nation, we are back taking a look at the August 10th, 1985 Madison Square Garden house show. Of course, Kelly Nelson of Titans of Wrestling at the Garden. Tech, he's back again. I think they're all dead shows, but he's here with us anyway.
I still have imaginary stories.
That's right. Him and Johnny Sorrow are doing imaginary stories on the PTBN
every
pop feed. So.
Well, that's because Johnny Sorrow's imaginary. That's why.
Yeah, his whole life is an imaginary story. and so, here we are, placemation.com, of course. We'll talk about that a little bit later when we plug what's going on. But I say we dive right back into the ceremony here. And we actually head right backstage for a troika of interviews.
Forgot our report.
Oh, God. I'm sorry. I'm all thrown off with Kelly here. Yes. Kelly. Okay. Sorry. And Kelly. I even heard the music in my ear, and I went right by it. It was, of course, Shout. How could I miss Tears for Fears screaming in my ear? I'm sorry,
exactly.
Scott. Forgive me. I'm going
to
turn things over to you.
35, you and Parva. You have to sit in a room with Parva and watch 35 years of Pedro Morales.
That's right. The Johnny Sorrow thing threw me off. But that should have been the tip because he's a big pop culture guy as well. So here we are, Scott Criscolo with the Pop Culture Corner.
Yes. As you know, Kelly, we kind of go into history on this day that we're doing the show. And we begin with a little music. And as you heard, a little Tears for Fears. On Saturdays, as I mentioned, the Billboard Top 100 Hot 100 comes out. So on this day, it actually came out because we are on a Saturday. So on the date of August 10th, 1985, you see its first week at number one. It's now back-to-back weeks, Shout by Tears for Fears. Going down the list, the top three remained the same from the previous week. Number two, Every Time You Go Away by Paul Young, which is a dreadfully bad song. And number three, Sting, of course, fortifying his solo career. If you love somebody, set them free. Number four, another awesome song from the 80s, Never Surrender by Corey Hart. Never surrender. Number five, The Power of Love by Huey Lewis, because in theaters at the moment, gentlemen, is, of course, Back to the Future. Yeah. So the soundtrack is rocking. So The Power of Love at number five by Huey. Number six, DeBarge with Who's Holding Donna Now? No, JR, not Donna Martin.
Mm.
We know Ray is holding Donna Martin.
And I do like DeBarge.
Then he throws it on the stickers.
El DeBarge.
El DeBarge. Number seven, Glory Days by The Boss, as he continues the pimping of... is that Born in the USA?
ASOB.
That's right, yes.
Glory Days.
Number eight, Freeway of Love by Vince's favorite artist, Miss Aretha Franklin. She's at number eight. At number nine, The Power Station, which is Robert Palmer and a bunch of guys from Duran Duran with Get It On, Bang a Gong, the T-Rex remake. And at number 10, You Give Good Love by the great Whitney Houston, which dropped four spots. So there's your top 10 on the Billboard Hot 100 on this date, August 10th, 1985.
Hmm.
Here are the movies, JR. Since it is a Saturday, movies were out the night before, August 9th. But one movie was out August 7th. And it was actually a pretty well-known comedy. This first movie. $12 million. Genius.
Mm.
Kelly, do you remember Real Genius?
Yes. Yeah, Val Kilmer.
Val Kilmer, JR. Maybe one of his first movies.
Mm.
So,
here you
what
go.
Is our background of Real Genius?
What up? 1 second. 1985 by Martha Coolidge. It did indeed star Val Kilmer and Gabriel Jarrett. The film is set on the campus of Pacific Tech, a technical university similar to Caltech. Chris Knight is a genius in his senior year working on a chemical laser. Mitch Taylor is a new student on campus paired up to work on the laser. There you go. Good positive reviews from critics.
Yes. So that came out on Wednesday the 7th. Kind of weird.
Trying to jump the gun. That is a real genius move.
Right. All right, so the movie, three movies came out that Friday, the night before, August 9th. This movie made a paltry $842,000. It is a drama, and it is called Dance with a Stranger.
Ooh.
Sounds like a movie that Savage would plug on the
USA. I was
USA.
Just about to say, it definitely
Friday
sounds like a USA.
USA movie,
this Wednesday on USA Disney.
Harry Hamlin.
Starring Miranda Richardson and Rupert Everett. Dance with a Stranger.
Second movie that came out that weekend.
By the way, she's a former nude model and prostitute. Ruth is manageress of a London drinking club, frequented by racing drivers, living in a flat above with her illegitimate son, Andy. So there you go. It's quite the scene setting.
The illegitimate son, the Planet Man. Now, all right, second movie that came out that weekend made $4.1 million, a comedy called My Science Project. I don't think it did well. $4.1 million isn't great, depending on the budget. But
it's a wannabe weird science.
Yeah.
Not as good as weird.
It looks like it should do with a UFO.
Guess. All right, and the big movie that weekend, one of our favorite comedians, I believe, was in this one. It made $24.67 million at the box office. The movie is Summer Rental.
Mm.
Mm.
I believe that's our man John Candy. If
yes, it is. Yeah, I've seen it several times.
Yeah.
Jack Chester, air traffic controller, given 4 paid weeks off. So there you go.
And that's all we need. So there you go. All right. So there's our.
John Larroquette was in that as well.
Was he really?
As Angus McLaughlin.
I believe Night Court was doing very well at this time as well. Okay, so there's your movies for the weekend. Sports-wise, really the only thing going on is the heat of the baseball season. We're in the pennant race. So Kelly, who's your team?
I'm a Blue Jays fan.
Well, you and JR then can bump loggerheads because 1985 was a big year for the Blue Jays.
Yes.
On this day, Saturday, August 10th, the Yankees went into Fenway, beat the Red Sox 7-3. Joe Cowley beat Oil Can Boyd. The Blue Jays were on the road, and they lost 4-3 in 10 innings to the Royals. Harbinger of things to
come. Ooh, yes. Mr. Nelson.
The Mets, meanwhile, they defeated the Cubs 8-3 at Shea. Doc Gooden winning his 18th that day. Your standings, as mentioned, Mr. Nelson's Blue Jays, 7 games ahead of the Yankees at this point. At this point in the standings. Yeah, Red Blue Jays playing very well. Yankees playing very well as well. In the West, the Angels, though, still...
Was Jose Bautista pouting on the team back then as well? Or is it just now?
That was George Bell.
Jerry
Curlitz.
That's right. His predecessor, George Bell, yes. Yeah.
And the cannon arm of Jesse Barfield, pre-Yankee trip to the Yankees. Right. The Angels were leading the AL West by 2.5 over the Royals. Isn't that crazy, Kelly, that mid-August and the Royals weren't even in first place? Isn't that wild? Crazy. The Mets and Cardinals in a dead heat in the NL East, as they would be most of the summer. And the Dodgers with a 6-game lead on the Reds and the Padres in the NL West. And, of course, guys, when we return to the Garden in September, we could talk a little NFL football.
Mm-hmm.
1980, they're in camp, of course, right now. And then we can
why did you say that like Oprah?
NFL football in the book club. Everybody wins a fucking car.
We can have Kelly back when we get to 1993, and he can talk about his 92, his little tiny run of Blue Jays greatness.
Blue Jays greatness right there.
But 85 actually was the year they won the most games in franchise history.
Yeah.
It
was a great
99.
Team.
It was a close race at the end with the Yankees. I think they only won by a couple games.
Yeah. So when we get to September, the 1985 NFL season will have began. We're in camp at the moment, so we'll get to that. Earlier in the month at Madison Square Garden, the first 2 days of the month, Tina Turner blew through with her private dancer tour, so that probably sold out.
Well, she just wants to dance with somebody, Scott.
I'm a private dancer. Opening for her was the late, great Glenn Frey opened for her. And there was
Did
one
I mix
death
up Whitney Houston and Tina Turner?
What's that?
Did I mix up Whitney Houston and Tina Turner? Who does I just want to dance with somebody. I did. Well, they could be a tag team.
Yes, because they only work together, apparently. And there was a death. Nothing crazy, but I wanted to bring it up because he might be as old as Les Thatcher. But Kenny Baker, who was an American singer, died on this date in 1985. He was 72. He was a singer back in the 30s and 40s. He had a lot of big radio shows. He was on with he did some musicals with Gilbert and Sullivan. He was on what's his name? I lost the name on the sheet here. He was a regular performer on Fred Allen's Texaco Star Theater in the 40s. After retiring from performing, he became a Christian Science practitioner, which I didn't realize was around in the 50s, and a motivational speaker. And he also recorded a number of record albums for hymns for his church. So he died of a heart attack on this date, 72 years old. And we didn't want to confuse this gentleman with the Kenny Baker that played R2-D2. because he only died like last year. Mm-hmm. So that is it. So there is your pop culture report for this date, August 10th, 1985. All right, we're at the intermission here at the Garden, and JR, we have Gorilla Goes in the back with some, as Alfred would say, pre-recorded interviews.
Yes, he sure does. Chats to Paul Orndorff. Paul puts over Andre the Giant as a great tag team partner, says it'll be a heck of a battle, and you have to know how far you can push Andre without making him mad. Gorilla wonders how Paul can control Andre out there. I don't know if he really has to control him, but Gorilla then chats with Roddy Piper and Bob Orton. Piper jokes about Andre mentally preparing himself and compares it to a snail preparing for the Olympics. Piper says Andre's big and bent out of shape, or is he just preparing to be bent out of shape in the ring? Piper rambles as Gorilla ends the interview. Another great Piper interview. Gorilla then chats with Randy Savage. Says he'll burn the building down MSG style, and he's the greatest pro wrestler in the world. George Wells gets to go against the best, but it isn't good enough, and Savage will be visualizing Hulk Hogan across the ring from him during the bout. So Savage still pushing his desire to face off with Hulk Hogan for the WWF title. So
And then Paul Orndorff said, as for a Tony Atlas, George Wells team, if you kind of like that sort of thing.
Yeah, right. He's not into that.
No. All right, so we get back to the ring, and speaking of Mr. Orndorff and Mr. Piper, yes. JR, here we are with our, I guess you could say, our co-main event, because this is a pretty swank tag match, isn't it?
This is a red-hot match here. So, of course, Orndorff and Piper have been having this awesome feud. We talked about their great singles match on a recent show. And here, Piper's with his buddy Orton, and he is taking on Orndorff and the returning Andre the Giant, who, Kelly, how long had he been gone since Mania? Because he... we haven't seen him at MSG, but was he pretty much just coming back before this show?
I want to say he's probably doing a tour of Japan, because right. He was still doing that as late as 85. Even in 86, he was still doing Japanese tours, so that's probably where he was.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think we've seen him much after Mania. So we might have looked this up last time, or a recent time, Scott, but yeah. He definitely took time off after Mania. I'm trying to look quick at Graham, if I can see. I mean, he's around April... he's in Japan. I think we looked at this. It was April's last time. Then he returns in July. He's still getting subbed out in July. So the end of July is when he comes back. So, yeah, this is pretty much the first time we're seeing him back here. Huge match off the heels of the hot brawl last month between Piper and Orndorff. Great heat for Piper and Orton as usual. Andre gets a massive pop for his big return. Match starts hot with a wild brawl between all four men that ends with Piper and Orton regrouping outside after getting smacked around. The crowd is bananas here as Andre and Orndorff rile them up. Andre flips Piper back inside but gets trapped in the heel corner. That backfires as Andre slips free and Piper collides with Orton. Orndorff tags in and dropkicks Piper and works the arm as Alfred puts over Andre and Orndorff for coming in with a great game plan. Piper goes to the eyes and buries a knee lift and tags out, but Orndorff recovers and rolls Orton up for two before Piper can make the save. Andre tags in and kicks Orton in the head and then starts trying to rip off the cast by tearing at it and then smashing it on the turnbuckle. Orton keeps flailing away and trying to escape, but Andre has the arm locked tight as he works the tape. Andre chokes Orton with the tape and then chokes Piper when he comes in for the save. Orndorff works over Orton as the referee is tied up with Andre and Piper in the corner. Andre ties Piper with a tag rope around his neck and squashes him in the corner and then walks over and just steps on Orton. Orndorff drops an elbow for two, but Piper again makes a save. Orndorff works the arm, tags in Andre, goes back to ripping at the cast. Orton just keeps trying to escape, but he can't break free until he eventually reaches out far enough to tag Piper, who comes in, and him and Orton gang up on Andre, choking him with the tape while piling him on him against the ropes. Orndorff comes over and beats on Orton on the floor, and Piper keeps choking away. Piper and Orton double team and do whatever they can to keep Andre compromised, but the Giant bites Piper to buy himself a minute. Orton tags in and cracks, and Andre cracks him with a punch. He bites him and tags out. Orndorff hits an atomic drop and goes over and hammers away at Piper, and everything breaks down from there. As Andre comes in and works over Orton, as Orndorff slugs away with Piper, Andre pushes Orton to the corner, but Ace knees him in the kidney to send him to the mat. Orndorff dumps Piper, and Andre kicks Orton in the head as he comes off the middle rope. Orndorff would pounce and cover Orton for the win. That was a great red-hot wild brawl with nonstop action. The energy is nuts from all four of these guys. MSG's rocking the whole time. The spectacle of Andre being added to this feud was a great idea. It makes it feel even larger than life. Plenty of gas left in the Orndorff-Piper feud, and the crowd is still very into it. I went 3.5 here. I thought this was a ton of fun. What'd you think, Scott?
I give this 4 stars. This was awesome. It woke up a crowd that sat through a lot of slog early on. And this was what they were waiting for. Mm-hmm. I think they were kind of percolating as the show progressed and was ready to just let loose when these guys came out. It's, I mean, how often do we really see Andre and Piper together? I think that's what makes this even better. It's two right. bona fide superstars that you don't really see together that often. Maybe a couple. I mean, I know they've been on a couple of pits, but in terms of actually wrestling, very rare. And excuse me. I mean, it was the crowd. I mean, it's nuclear. Absolutely nuclear. I love the move. Piper's just so fucking great. He while Andre's trying to undo, and I don't understand this. Why Andre is Andre the first guy smart enough to try and actually take the cast off?
Yeah, he's
I
mean, been he was gnawed at it like the whole time with his hand, you yeah, know, clawed and gnawed and did yeah, every could.
And I like how he's unwrapping it, and then Orndorff blind tags Piper. The ref sees it, and then Piper just grabs the tape and just starts choking Andre with it in like one motion. It was really sweet. Great job by Piper there. I mean, this match is just fantastic. I mean, just movement everywhere, crowds through the roof. You don't need any organization. You want the chaos. It's exactly what this match needed. It was perfect. It was a perfect setup. I go four. I mean, it woke this crowd up big time. And I think matches like this are even more highlighted because of what's around it. And again, the first few matches were definitely a slog. So this just woke everybody up and really jacked the crowd up. So I give this 4 stars. Kelly?
Yeah, I love this one too. Well, this is the match that drew the house. Right. Totally. This had all the headliners in it. The Piper Orndorff feud is pretty underrated, actually. Mm-hmm. And it produced a ton of great, you know, be it singles matches or tags like this. The energy is always, you know, so high. Just nonstop action. Yeah, and it was about the perfect time, you know, 8-9 minutes. Didn't want to go too long. And, you know, for a wild brawl, it shouldn't go too much longer than that anyway. That's like a perfect brawl time.
Yes.
Total mayhem. And it left you wanting more. I mean, Orton's the one who eats the pins. So, of course, Piper escapes, as he always does. So you got more. You can bring this back in different forms, another Piper-Orton match or a Piper-Orndorff match or whatever. I give it 3.5 stars. I really, really liked it.
It was a lot of fun. I mean, the crowd was really so into it. I mean, they were just red hot. Yeah. It was a good return for Andre. I mean, you throw him because obviously he's coming back in. He's kind of got the stud thing lingering, but he's not really like he doesn't have a ready-made microwave feud. And you're not going to roll Andre back out there for, you know, for nothing. Like, you're not going to throw him out there with a bum. So there was a perfect opening here where they could throw him in as the enforcer, backing up Orndorff against Piper. It was like a ready-made fit for him to come back in and kind of get reintroduced and back into the flow.
Yeah, and Piper had a past with Andre, too, from Piper's pits and tag matches and stuff. So there was a history there. A perfect role for Andre as the hired enforcer, basically.
Yeah, so there you go. Big win. Orndorff gets a little bit of revenge on Piper, and that feud will continue to stay hot.
No doubt about it. And we've gotten Piper to me is still the number one heel in the company, I think, right now. No doubt about it.
Oh, yeah.
And I think him being and one thing about Piper, and I don't think he gets a lot of credit over his career, but he when you have a show like this, and as you can tell, we don't have no Hogan on this show because we would have had him by now. He never wrestled the last match at the Garden, and he was not at the show in Anaheim. So another off night for the world champion. The one thing about Piper, and I kind of want your thoughts on this, Kelly. The one thing about Piper is he can elevate any baby faces just by being there. And I think it almost kind of fills gaps when you have a situation where Hogan is not around. Mm-hmm. And I mean, not that Andre and Orndorff. Well, maybe Orndorff a little, but not Andre. Andre is the boss. I mean, he stands alone. But you know what I'm saying? Like, what are your thoughts on that? That Piper just at shows where there is no Hogan can help elevate other baby faces and make matches just as hot. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. I mean, a perfect example that I can think of was from late '84 when Snuka was out and the Tonga Kid had to come in and go against Piper at the Garden, and that was the main event. And I think they sold that show out. And Piper, because he just had so much heat from Piper's pit and just being a total madman.
Right.
Piper's one of my favorites of all time. Just such a great heel. At this time, at his peak, 1985, he could do no wrong. And everything he touched was gold, basically. And he was so on fire. and so valuable for them because, yeah, he could when Hogan's not there. He's basically number two. I mean, right. Andre's big two, of course, and always will be. But Piper was just in another zone. I mean, as far as heels went, so hot. And he never really got his comeuppance, and he kept, you know, he never blew him off at all. Mm-hmm. And just put him in another feud, and he was still so hot. And just, yeah, just one of the all-time greats, of course.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how, you know, Hogan, obviously the most over guy, period, can take a day off from, I mean, obviously you had Tito at the other venue, but to have Piper here, he elevates any babyface and just makes a show even more important and hotter. Now, our length, that match was 8:25. Perfect length, too, right, JR? Mm-hmm. It didn't need to be any longer. You know, it didn't need to be any longer. It was a perfect, right, Kelly? Matches with Piper, you don't need Piper in 16-minute matches. There's no need for that because there's no wasted space, no wasted time. It's all it's all motion, it's all chaos, it's all action. So you don't need Piper in 15-minute matches. 8 minutes is perfectly fine for him. You know,
mm-hmm. No, Piper was the master of mm-hmm. the 5 to 10 minute wild scrappy brawl. That's another thing that he doesn't get a lot of credit for that either. Pete from Titans, you know, that's, he loves those Piper's matches, and there's so many great ones from the 80s where it's just, and of course the heat is just so crazy, and Piper, he cornered the market on that match.
Yep, absolutely. All right, next, JR, I believe this is his first appearance since he made his big debut earlier in the year, mm-hmm. Taking on a replacement for somebody else. What happened?
Yeah. Well, as you heard earlier, Randy Savage called out George Wells, but Wells was suffering from an eye injury at the time. He's actually here. He comes out and is introduced to the crowd, greets the crowd. Fink explains the injury, says it's due to a scratched cornea, and he is replaced by Jose Luis Rivera, the always standing by just in case. And I love Savage, too, the energy. He's this nonstop motion during the introductions. Like, as they're going through all this, he's just pacing like a madman. Gorilla puts over Savage's charisma as Fink announces him as wrestling's number one free agent. We get plenty of stalling and posturing to start as Gorilla talks about all the managers they've tried to sign Savage in recent weeks. Savage finally disrobes, and we get underway as Gorilla reminds us that Savage is unbeaten. Rivera grabs a waist lock, but Savage reaches the ropes to break. Rivera charges, but Savage slaps him and bails to the floor, showing his amazing speed. Savage gets into it with the fans and comes back in, but we just get more stalling. They finally engage again, and Savage takes Rivera down off a lockup and goes to a front face lock. Rivera ducks an elbow and gets a crossbody for two, and then sends Savage crashing hard to the mat by blocking a roll-up. Rivera gets a sunset flip for two, but Savage pops up and levels him with a clothesline. Savage nails a high crossbody off the top rope for two and then heads back up again. This time, Rivera cracks him in the gut with a right hand. Rivera dropkicks Savage to the floor, and when Macho gets back in, Rivera runs him to the buckle. Just when Rivera's feeling good, Savage shakes his head off with a sit-out clothesline and then drops a knee on him for two before going to the chin lock. Savage keeps unloading with elbows and knocks Rivera outside. Macho hops out as well, drills Rivera with a headbutt from behind, and then drags him back inside. Savage hangs Rivera in the tree of woe, kicks away, and then shoves Rivera back to the floor. Savage heads up and levels him with an axe handle blow and then tosses Jose over the barricade into the crowd. Savage goes up top again, hits another axe handle just as Rivera climbs back over. Savage runs Rivera to the ring steps and runs him into the steel turnbuckle as he tries to climb back in. Savage suplexes Rivera back to the ring for two, but Rivera he pulls Rivera up to keep the match going. Savage again pitches Jose to the floor and then levels him with another axe handle off the top rope. Savage yells at Gorilla and then gets caught by a Rivera right hand. Back inside, Savage catches Jose Luis on the way back in and dodges a dropkick. Savage goes for another cover and pulls him up again, but a second later, Rivera gets a near fall on an inside cradle. Savage keeps on the pressure until he suplexes him and then wrecks him with the flying elbow for the win. Savage is an absolute beast. I love how he uses the whole ringside area to beat the piss out of these guys. Like, he goes in the ring, out of the ring, in the ring, out of the ring. He uses every inch of real estate he has. And Rivera gives it a go. He continues to improve. The last two times we've seen him, he's been better. But Savage just beats the shit out of him belt to belt, toys with him for most of the match. And based on the commentary and the results, Savage's star is clearly high, high, high on the rise at this point. Two stars for this, only because I love Savage's manic offense, and I thought Rivera did a nice job bumping around for him. I just love how he's in constant motion and all over the place. That's my favorite part about Savage. What'd you think of this one, Kelly?
Well, it was, I think, the longest squash match in wrestling history.
Right? Definitely. Yeah, it was a lengthy one.
Yeah, like 16 minutes plus. A lot of stalling. Savage looks awesome. I mean, he was just starting out here. You know, he was great. Jose Luis Rivera, on the other hand, is a pretty poor wrestler. Just not a good baby face. I've seen quite a few Jose Luis Rivera matches. It's just, there's no sympathy to him. He can't get really fired up. No one really cares. Later, he dons a mask and he wrestles as, well, first part of the Shadows tag team. And then later, more famously, with the Conquistadors. And he's actually pretty decent in that role. But yeah, as a baby face, he's amongst one of the just least impressive I've come across. But enough about him. This is all about Savage, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know if you needed to go 16 minutes. I mean, Savage was still in full-on Memphis mode, doing all the outside stuff and getting into it with the crowd. And yeah, I don't think the crowd ever lost interest in this one. But it just kept going. There was actually one point where Macho even started jawing with Gorilla that I thought was kind of interesting. That was like kind of an interesting, you know, tease or something there. Because Gorilla rarely ever got involved once he was a commentator with any of the wrestlers. So that was kind of neat. But yeah, it's a very long squash match. I went 1.5 stars on it.
The I'm wondering if because George Wells was kind of getting more of a push than like Rivera, like he was a little higher regarded, if that slot, yeah. That's why they got 16, because that slot was set for more of a, less of a squash. But then once they switched it, they're like, well, we can't let Rivera get offense on Savage. So just beat the shit out of him, pick him up a bunch of times.
And that's a weird thing I meant to mention, is that as late as like right before the match started, they had George Wells' name in the, on the graphic on the screen as going with Savage. It's strange that went so long. And then, of course, Savage did cut a promo on him in the locker room. Like, was it legit like a last second
decision? Right. They checked him and decided it was just, you know, too late or whatever.
Or, yeah, you know, too much. So. Yeah. Cause it seemed like they were all in. It was going to happen. They had the graphic. So he was ready to take on the Canadian football man, as he called. I think he was, almost had a 10-year career, if I'm not mistaken, in the CFL, George Wells.
Yeah, he did. We chronicled his teams, I think, on that Maple Leaf Gardens Tower show on the Avenger.
Yes, those guys could never get any of the teams.
Gorilla
right.
and Jack Reynolds and Jesse, we got like fucked up like 5 times the teams that he was on.
I mean, how many teams are in the CFL, Kelly? Like 8 or 10?
Currently,
like, 12?
No. I think 9. Like, I've lost interest in the CFL in the last decade. Ottawa just got a team back not too long ago, so I think that made it 9.
Let's put it this way: let's say in 1985 there were 12 teams in the CFL, and George Wells played for 3 of them. Well, Jack Reynolds and Jesse kept naming the other 9. It just couldn't get the 3 that he played for right. It was ridiculous, but. Tonight, though, if you look closely, George Wells' left eye did look a little weird, though.
Yeah.
Like, it just looked a little swollen. I mean,
I think he was legitimately hurt. The question is, did they think he could maybe gut it out and then he realized he couldn't?
Probably.
Or was there like a backstage fight that we're unaware of that happened like just before the match started?
Right. True. Yeah.
That
maybe
could have Barrett happened.
And George Wells had a fisticuffs to decide who gets to be squashed.
Tony Atlas and George Wells. I don't want to be your partner, man.
Give it up.
Give it up. I don't mind wrestling with white guys. No. This match is really such a strange, strange and fantastic template for pre WrestleMania 3 Randy Savage. Watching a lot of the stuff, I've watched a lot of his Memphis stuff, and his one thing about it that I definitely agree with you, JR, is that he constantly is in motion. Even if he's not doing anything, even if he's not actually putting a move on somebody, Savage doesn't stand there. He's always moving, whether he's running around the ring or he's on the ropes, or he's never in neutral. Mm-hmm. He's never in park. He's always in drive. And that's what makes a simple squash like this. I mean, for God's sakes, this match is And this match is 16-14.
Yeah.
16 minutes, and how many moves did Rivera get in? Like three?
I mean, three too many. Yes.
Yeah. Right at the beginning, the first couple
you know?
Minutes.
Yeah. So 16 minutes of Savage just fucking pummeling this guy. And he didn't – he ran – he just moved around a lot. It was an interesting situation because it wasn't typical Memphis stalling because it's not a lot of pointing and crowd jacking and all that shit. It was a lot of just moving around and it was just – it was so well done. And I will give kudos to Jose Luis Rivera because if this was an audible, he did the right thing. He settled in. He didn't stooge around and look like a dope. He let Savage kind of go with it and do what he needed to do and get the job done. Now, if this was an audible, I could not see Savage and George Wells going 16 minutes. I really don't. I think they did add a little extra time, perhaps. But I mean, it was just a fantastic snapshot of Savage right before he really settled into the WWF style of working TV matches and pay-per-views. That he knows how to just keep the level going even in a match that clearly could have ended 12 minutes earlier. He really kept it going for the fans. So, and I love Savage's early robes, kind of like those Asian. Oh, sorry,
yeah.
I'll use Kelly Nelson's relative, Larry Nelson's terminology. Those Orientals and their robes. they're not related. I love those older robes that have kind of the Asian look to them. But it was just a great snapshot of Savage in that mid 80s, really not quite honed down level yet. But mentioning anytime you this will be my last thought. Anytime if you're pushing a guy, anytime you reference him with Hogan, I mean every wrestler could mention Hogan. You know, it's a question of if the commentators will roll with it or not. If somebody mentions, you know, I'll get in the ring with Hogan someday and then they no sell it, that means the guy's a hump. But the fact that Gorilla and Alfred did roll with it for most of this match means that this guy's a player. And that alone keeps you invested in him. This isn't the missing link. Right. You know what I mean? So anyway, Savage wins an extended squash and another great, you know, example of how fantastic he can be when he's got a goal that he needs to set when he gets to the ring.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before we get to the main event, JR, the Fink comes out to kind of let us know about what we're going to see next month.
Why don't you cover off on that? I didn't write it down this time.
Oh, no problem. He announced two matches. One of them is a match that was 3,000 miles away in Anaheim on this day. Ricky the Dragon Steamboat will take on Parv's other favorite wrestler, the Magnificent Morocco. And the second match, they called it, what do you call it, the Colossal?
The Colossal Jostle.
The Colossal Jostle, that's it. The Colossal Jostle. King Kong Bundy and Andre the Giant. So that's only two matches that he announced. So those two matches coming up on our next foray, which will be September 23rd.
Yes.
So there's your next house show, and that's two of the matches. All right, it is time for our main event, our one title match of the evening. The World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Championships are on the line. JR, who are the U.S. Express taking on?
Still above 50 days into their second reign, and they are taking on a team that we've seen work together before, and that is Brutus Beefcake and Greg Valentine. Jimmy Hart and Johnny V both out at ringside to bring out the Hammer and the Beefer for this big tag team title bout, and Hart calls them the Dream Team to fans during introductions as the challengers draw some good heat. So kind of, sort of, maybe getting there. And it's funny to me that they had this thing, I guess, in their minds for a while, because they were teaming while Valentine was still champ, and then as soon as he loses the belt, they're like, boom, together. So they must have had this in mind for quite a bit leading up to that, but it's a good pairing for reasons we've discussed before. A huge pop for Born in the USA, as the champs and Lou Albano power walk to the ring. Gorilla talks about how focused and pissed off Valentine is after losing his IC title. We get a long stare down and posturing before the bell. The match finally gets underway with the hammer and the Wyndham. Hammer strikes first, but Wyndham dodges an elbow and the champs go to work, mixing in tags and arm work. Hammer tries to turn the tide, but Rotundo stunts that and keeps control of the arm. Hammer eventually fights free and tags in Beefcake, who gets a very brief flurry before Rotundo starts to work a headlock on him. The champ keeps tagging and grinding, not giving Beefcake a chance to gain any momentum. Wyndham cuts off another Beefcake attempt with a big dropkick before going back to work on the headlock. Beefcake is finally able to slam Wyndham, but he misses an elbow drop and allows Rotundo to tag in, and Mike goes right to work on the headlock. Beefcake fights up and buries a tight knee, but Rotundo catches Beefcake by the arm, takes him down, and spins him into a headlock. Beefcake again powers up and shoots Rotundo to the ropes, allowing Hammer to clobber him from behind, finally swinging control of the match. The challengers go to work, alternating punishing the back of Rotundo, with Hammer getting a two count and a backbreaker. Beefcake pitches Rotundo hard to the floor, where Wyndham goes to check on him and helps him back in. Beefcake grabs Rotundo as he comes in and hits a triple backbreaker for a near fall. Rotundo catches a flash near fall and a cross body, but gets shipped to the floor again, where Wyndham checks on him and pushes him back inside. The challengers keep the pressure on, keeping up their tags and staying locked in on the back. Rotundo would grab a near fall in a small package after blocking the suplex, but Hammer worked a great heel tactic by slugging Wyndham to draw him into the referee, leading to a nice double team on the other side. Rotundo tries to fight his way out of trouble, but Hammer keeps control and turns him into a Boston Crab. Rotundo powers out, but Hammer recovers in time to block the tag in a great tease spot there. Rotundo gets super close to a tag a second time, but Hammer catches him and he dives. It hooks him in a bear hug that he turns into an inverted atomic drop. Hammer unleashes a stiff series of knees to the lower back and tags in Beefcake, who keeps Rotundo grounded. Hammer baits Wyndham in again, and that allows Beefcake to choke. The crowd tries their best to rally Rotundo as the challengers batter him around, pick up a very close near fall. Hammer makes his way back in and starts to lower some heavy blows, works the back into a bear hug and into a double underhook. Rotundo blocks a pile driver with a backdrop and crawls to his corner, but Beefcake runs in and cuts him off. But then a moment later, Rotundo slips free and makes the hot tag to a massive pop. Wyndham cleans house as the crowd went bananas, but are short-lived because Beefcake turns the tide and uses an assist from Hammer to keep him down. Gorilla notes that Wyndham has to suck it up here because Rotundo won't be ready to come back in, and right on cue, Wyndham fires up and lays in some hard punches to the Hammer. Valentine cuts him off, but Wyndham blocks the figure four, and a moment later, they collide on a crisscross, and everything breaks down from there into a big brawl with a wild airplane spin by Rotundo on Valentine. Beefcake makes a save there on the pin cover. Valentine goes to the figure four, but as he does, Wyndham flies over his back and rolls him up with a win for the win in a massive pop. I thought this was an awesome match, built beautifully with the early mat work and twisted into a hot heat segment filled with good teases and comeback attempts, capped by a great House of Fire entrance by Wyndham and a strong, clean finish to wrap it up. I thought the chemistry was fantastic here. It was stiff. It was hard fought. It was a hot battle. The champs keep the titles, and I think that was key for them because, you know, coming off that loss to Sheik and Volkov, they kind of needed to reestablish themselves as how good they really are, and a win like this clean really helped, and I think the Dream Team may be legit. We'll see. I went 4 stars on this, and I really, really liked it. I thought it's one of the best matches we've seen, Scott, since we restarted this reboot. What do you think?
I agree with you 100%. I give it 4 stars as well. I was surprised. The one thing, you know, the aesthetic side of me, because as everyone knows, I'm a belt nerd. I thought at this point they had ditched the older belts and were with the current belts. But when Wyndham and Rotundo came out, they still had those older, smaller NWA-ish looking belts still. So they hadn't switched to the new ones yet. Interesting question here. As much as the Dream Team or this team put together. I'm going to continue my comments. I'm going to throw a question to you, Kelly, when you do your comments. Great storytelling. U.S. Express are good sellers. Both Wyndham and Rotundo are great sellers. They take a good beating, and there's no doubt that the tutorial that Valentine has given Beefcake has done wonders. Beefcake, for the first time, really looked like he didn't need to have his hand held in this match. I mean, he really felt like he knew what he was doing. He was moving around the ring like a, you know, I don't say a ring general, but, you know, like a guy who's been in the business for a bit. He didn't seem very inexperienced. So that helped a lot. It didn't seem like he was kind of just moving around and Valentine was doing all the psychology-driven storytelling. It was a great match. I mean, it was 24:02. Wow.
Yeah.
That might be the – I think that's the longest match we've had so far, JR. in our reboot. I think it's 24 minutes is pretty long. So the last 2 minutes, the last two matches were almost 40 minutes. So it took pretty much the last hour of the show, introductions included, was probably these last two matches. Kelly, as I pass off to you, when you make your comments, if you can kind of intertwine your answer here, is this a downgrade? Did this seem like a downgrade for Greg Valentine? Loses the IC belt in July. Savage is here now. Did it seem like he was pushed down to the tag division? Or do you think this was even if Savage wasn't here, this was where Valentine was going to end up anyway? Did it seem like a demotion for the Hammer or just kind of a lateral move to this tag team situation?
I don't think it was a demotion. He'd been in the IC scene for a bit, and the way they did things and still to this day do things is, you know, you got to move someone on. The tag belts were over. They were important. And, you know, I think the team was put together with Beefcake because, you know, they needed someone to sort of help Beefcake out. I don't think he was going anywhere really as a singles guy. So matching him up with Valentine in a tag was a great move. Valentine, maybe or probably the best wrestler, you know, bell to bell, night in, night out in the company at the time, well respected. So, yeah, I don't think it was a demotion because, like I said, yeah, the belts were still important. They could still be used to help draw on houses. It would be, you know, obviously later the belts would lose a lot of their luster, and being put into a tag was kind of a sign that, you know, they didn't really have much left for you. In a couple more years, yeah, after the second Dream Team sputters out, then, you know, then you can see Valentine getting kind of shunted down the cards. But at this time, he was still a pretty valuable part of the whole team, I would say.
Okay. Hey, what are your thoughts on the match in general?
Oh, yeah. This was great. You know, when Marty and I started the Tag Teams Back Again podcast, I think Marty suggested this one. We go together, I looked at the card, show to come on for. And when I saw this match, I thought, okay, yeah, I'll take this card because it would give me a chance to finally watch this match. And great match. They have a match a couple weeks later in Philly that's very similar to this. Actually, that's the title switch match. Mm-hmm. Where they, like you talked about the old belts, they do have the new belts in Philly, Scott. So in 2 weeks, the new belts get commissioned at some point.
Yeah, because these old, you could tell even here, these belts are starting to look a little, they've seen better
days.
Well,
they look like the, I think it was the U.S. belts.
Yeah, they look like the ones that Ole and Arn had, the U.S. tag straps. They definitely look like those. I agree with you. That's a good call. I agree with you on that.
Yeah, and even I think the U.S. title when Magnum TA had it looked very similar.
Right, before they switched over to the big, nice belt. Yep, I agree.
Yeah, so that, yeah, these belts, yeah, you're right. They never looked right. Same with the belt that Hogan has at this point. Looked a lot like the NWA TV title.
TV belt, yep, and the National Heavyweight belt, same looking plate. Yep.
Yeah. So they switched over to a new belt maker because the new Intercontinental title just got revamped right around this time as well.
So that's probably when they went to Reggie Parks, most likely.
Right.
Because that's Reggie Parks' template, that IC belt.
Yeah. And Hogan would get a new belt by, I don't know, well, at least by WrestleMania 2 he has. The new belt.
The oblong-looking one. Yep.
Yeah, so there's a total overhaul. Back to the match. Yeah, the heat on Rotunda, the face in peril was just awesome in this match. I loved how there was so many teases and they kept cutting them off. That was great. And they had back psychology. They worked on his back and they were consistent with that. I mean, Hammer even went for a Boston Crab that, you know, he wouldn't... normally use that, so very consistent. They milked that hot tag as well as like any Southern tag team or in a Southern tag match that you'd see anywhere. It was really well done. And then I guess that speaks a bit. Well, look at the participants. You have Valentine, who wrestled a ton in Crockett. Wyndham and Rotundo were from Florida. And then you have Beefcake. But the majority of the match is with guys from the South.
Who wrestled in Hogan's Pool.
So. Yes. But no, and going forward, I mean, you guys are lucky because you're going to see a lot of awesome Dream Team matches. I mean, that's one of the big highlights of 86, 85 and 86 is the Dream Team matches, because they go through a whole bunch of different teams and have great matches all the time. Yeah, I went 4 stars with this one too. My first 4-star match.
There you go.
I was debating to, you know, should I use the quarter stars and all that, and yeah, because I mean the finish was a little like after the hot tag, you know,
right.
I was a little disappointed that they cut off Wyndham's House of Fire so quickly.
That seems to be a theme in a lot of the shows we've watched here in these tag matches, that it's happened in recent ones we've talked about, Scott. It happens again next month, where the heat segment ends, you get the big, you know, hot tag, and then yeah, it lasts like a minute, and then it gets cut off, and then it gets to the finish. So it must have been something in the booking during this stretch, because this is not the only match we've watched or will watch where they have that exact formula where the hot tag doesn't get right to the finish.
Yeah, must be a particular agent who has that. That's his go-to structure. So the end, I mean, yeah, and it ended well. With, of course, the baby faces getting the win, sends everybody home happy. Yeah, 4 stars. It was a really good match. Awesome.
Yep. So the U.S. Express retain their World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Championships. All right, so there you go. There's your show from the Garden, August 10th, 1985. And JR, it's time to give out some awards.
Yeah, let's do it, Kelly. I believe you prepped your awards as well. You're ready to participate here?
Yeah, I'm all ready to go.
All right, so match of the night, I think, is an easy call based on our star ratings. It was the tag title match to close the show.
Yep.
Okay. Very good. Sorry, I'm trying to type on our little spreadsheet, and I screwed it all up. I'm still fucking it up. All right. So our Drizzler, which is our worst match of the night, of course, coined by Parv way back when he was on with us. And to me, this was an interesting decision because there was a lot of bad stuff, but it was all kind of on the same level. Like, to me, nothing stood out amongst all the bad stuff as, like, really bad. But I went with Fulton Roma. I thought it was so fucking boring. I felt like there was a little something redeeming, at least in all the other matches. That was my choice. Would you go with Kelly?
Yeah, I went with the same match. It was slightly worse than the Atlas-Thornton match for me. Yeah, it was really just dreadful, dreadful shit.
What do you think, Scott?
As much as I fucking hate Uncle Elmer, to as much as you do, I will never give Big John Studd the Drizzler ever. So I'll stick with Roman Fulton.
And that match was short and hot. This one was just dragged on. And this set was so much more boring. At least Elmer Studd had some fucking energy to it, and the ending was cool. So.
MVP?
Yes, our MVP, I went with Andre the Giant. I thought he was overall, his comeback was really good. I thought he was a lot of fun in the match. I loved him going after the cast and, you know, everything he did with that. I thought he was really the center that everything orbited around in that match. Like, everything built around what he was doing, and I thought he was the best presence. And it was great to see him back, so I thought he was the most over. As hot as that feud was being... has been recently. I thought Andre like really put it over the edge this month, so I went with him. What'd you have, Scott?
Yeah, I had Andre as well. Just incredible worker. I wanted to give it to all four guys, but I'll give it to Andre because he kind of slipped into this feud like a glove without even really being part of it. So, and I like what he did with Orton's cast. So definitely to Andre. Kelly?
I went with Valentine. But Andre's a good pick too. I didn't even actually really think about Andre, but that's a good call. But I went with Valentine because, you know, he's kind of the ring general, the guy who made that match great. I mean, not to say that the U.S. Express didn't do their part, but I think, you know, you'll see going ahead, the common denominator is usually Greg Valentine right. in all these great matches.
And he has been, you know, so great in a lot of the ones we've seen. He's usually either our match of the night or MVP. And this actually mirrors the last time Andre was on, our first ever episode from January. Scott, you picked Andre and I picked Greg Valentine, and here we are all these shows later. Andre and Greg Valentine are the two MVPs, so pretty funny. Our spoiler award, who is the worst worker of the night, this I did give to Uncle Elmer unabashedly. as much fun as some of that bump, you know, the big Haas stuff was, he is just terrible, and I don't feel bad at all about calling him out as terrible. I think he's the worst worker on this night. Kelly?
I'm going to go with Charlie Fulton. He was in the worst match, so therefore, using that philosophy, he's the worst worker.
How about you, Scott?
I'm going to break the tie, and there is no question. I would much rather watch 20 minutes of boring Charlie Fulton than 2 minutes of anything Uncle Elmer ever did ever. So I'm going with Uncle Elmer.
There you go. Suck it, Uncle Elmer, you fat slob. All right.
And he's already dead, so it doesn't matter. Yeah.
Fuck the Plowboy. I feel like Plowboy is like the, you know, like fuckboy is the big term these days. Plowboy was like the 1980s of the fuckboys. All right. What do we got left here? We have our best moment. I went with Barry Windham's hot tag until he got cut off. That glimpse of awesomeness when the crowd just goes fucking bananas when he comes in and he cleans house. That was my choice. What'd you have, Scott?
Tough. I did like that, but I also, again, liked the move where Andre was so close to taking the cast off that no one noticed the hot tag, the secret tag to Piper, and then Piper just grabs the bandage out of nowhere and starts choking Andre with it. I thought that was awesome, but I'll go with the hot tag. I'll roll with that one. I thought the hot tag was good.
What'd you think, Kelly?
Yeah, well, it's unanimous then, because I went with the hot tag too. Such a great face in peril to build to that hot tag.
And they teased it so well a couple times.
Yeah, that would be, you know, show that to the kids at the developmental center and all that sort of stuff. That's picture perfect right there.
Yep.
All right, and our Mr. Wonderful Wonderful Award, who was our most juiced up guy in the night. I thought this was a pretty easy call on this evening for Tony Atlas. I don't think there's too much of a question here, but that's just me.
And we can officially rename it now because he has now broken the tie, because that is the third
time. Is that your choice as well,
it.
Though?
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, okay. Definitely. There's nobody really else that looked – Orndorff looked pretty normal on this night. I mean, he looked in great shape, but not like Tony Atlas.
How about you, Kelly?
Yeah, I went with Atlas, too.
All right. We're going to call it the Junior Mr.
Junior Mr. America Award.
Or... Universe. Junior Mr. Universe Award.
Junior Mr. Universe. Yeah, yeah.
Perfect. That's perfect.
So right now the tally is 3 for Tony Atlas. Let's see.
2 for Orndorff.
2 for Orndorff.
2 for Putski.
2 for Putski. And then 1 for Rocky Johnson, 1 for Rick McGraw, and 1 for the Bulldogs. So there's your
– And McGraw could have – I mean, he was like, you know, right along all these other guys. It could really be the quick draw award because he wasn't too far off from a lot of these guys. But Atlas is like next level. I mean, he's just fucking ridiculous.
I don't know if we ever see Rick McGraw again.
We do.
I was going to say you're running out of time. Cause
we do. We see him in September.
Okay. Oh, we do see him one more time. But I know he dies before the year.
Yeah, it's close.
It's a farewell.
Well, the saddest part is they do that segment on TNT that'll be coming on The Adventure for us where they talk about his wedding and they show like the wedding photos and all this stuff, and then he died like a few months later. And I was like, kind of tough to watch that.
Well, and then they famously air a match where Piper beats the shit out of him on the day that he actually died. To the point where an urban legend came up that Piper killed him.
Piper murdered him.
Sadly, he was such a heel that it's not that far.
Far-fetched.
I just want to end your marriage.
All right, so overall grade out of 10. I went with a 5, which is surprising considering how the show started. But I thought the matches were that good. The two big matches were that good. And, you know, when you're looking at these cards, it's WWF in the mid-80s. And I know there's some good stuff. But, like, to me, the good matches, the really good matches, so outweigh, like, 5 shit matches get outweighed by a 4-star match on one of these shows. Like, I don't roll into any of the shows expecting a 4-star match. So, to me, to get that main event, plus the Andre stuff, plus some fun Savage stuff, was enough to get me halfway. I couldn't go much higher because the rest of the card is pretty dreadful. So, I went 5 out of 10 here. What'd you do, Kelly?
Yeah, I went with the same rating. I've talked about this on Titans before, how, you know, MSG was all about the main event matches.
Right.
and you'd get a ton of crap underneath, and that's what drew the crowds. I compared it to like a boxing card. Like, you came to see the main event and maybe one other fight.
Right.
And you're going to get eight prelim fights. But nobody really cares. I mean, you're buying popcorn, you're doing other stuff. And that was how they booked MSG for years, that you would get two, three big matches. And they always delivered, you know. It was rare that you get a MSG card where the main event matches didn't deliver. And this was no exception. These were big ones.
Yep. Would you give it, Scott?
I mean, 4 stars for that main event, 24 minutes. I'm going to give it a slight tick. I'll give it a 5.5.
Okay.
The half star goes for that main event and the awesome Andre stuff. The undercard stuff was pretty bad, but I mean, the Uncle Elmer stuff was putrid, but I'll never blame Stud for that. 5.5 I think is perfect. I think the big matches at the end kind of bailed it out. Otherwise, it was looking more like a 3. But those matches
it was
those
looking
matches,
pretty bad until those.
Yep,
But those matches at the end really really tipped it up for me. So I'll give it a 5.5.
All right, so there you go, another one in the books. Kelly, I want to thank you for joining us here tonight. The final Titans of Wrestling drops this Wednesday in the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Of course, you can subscribe to all those feeds on iTunes, Pro Wrestling Only, Place to Be Nation Wrestling, and Place to Be Nation Pop. You can give ratings. You can leave feedback there as well. You can find us on social media on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter, Place Number 2B Nation. And Kelly, you have a Twitter as well, right?
Yes, it's at MSG1880.
So there you go. It's written in his name. Anything else you wanted to plug, Kelly?
No, not really. I mean, yeah, Titans drops Wednesday, the finale. Parv already put out a retrospective episode, number 76, which is actually awesome. He edited together a bunch of clips from past episodes with music and, some of his DJ Parv remixes yes. that he made over the years. So it's really a wonderful package. It's like on Facebook in a thread with all of us, Johnny said it was, you know, a Valentine to all of us. And it was, it's like a love letter to Titans. We couldn't go out on a higher note, I don't think. And I just want to say, yeah, thanks to you guys. This is great. You guys started it all. I mean, you started the, WWF, review shows that influenced Parv to start, the WCW review shows. And without that, without Parv getting into podcasts, there'd be no Titans of Wrestling. So,
there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been, what, 6 years? Wow.
Six years
for you guys. Wow. What a run. What a decade it's been.
what a decade.
It's a crazy run when you think of how many of these things we've done. But here
yeah.
we are, still going.
Yeah. And yeah, no, and we've got lots to come in the future. I'm taking a bit of a break, but I'll be back. I've got a lot of ideas for shows in the future that I want to
1984
yeah 1984 yes. someday for sure 1983-84 that'll be something to come back to, but yeah, other stuff, and I may get around to finishing Bruno at the Garden one of these days, and definitely Tag Teams back again. I want to reboot that at some point because we sort of just randomly ended it.
Yes.
But yes, I will be back.
Very good, and probably back with us. We'll see. Clotheslines and headlines last week. I want to everyone make sure you check that out. Brandon Howard from Fightful.com was on. He broke down the Q4 WWE financials, and he's awesome at that. Really good on the business end of wrestling, and he joined the crew. I was not on that episode, but it was a great interview. And they also covered a lot of Shikara as well with Glenn Butler and Steve Willey. So check that out. And next week, I think we have a pretty good episode planned. I'll be back. We'll save the details to be announced on social media, so follow us there over the next few days. Scott, do we have a main event this week?
We do. There'll be a main event recording Wednesday to drop late Wednesday, early Thursday. We have two fantastic guests. We're going to talk about what's going on tonight on Raw and, of course, the big Battle Royal tomorrow night on SmackDown Live. And I think we're going to delve back into history. We kind of scratched the surface on the February pay-per-views. We may go in a little more detail on that tomorrow night or on Wednesday night. So you'll be seeing that late Wednesday, early Thursday, the newest main event. Number 70.
Jeez, look at you.
This week, so. There you go.
Not bad. All right. Yeah. That'll do it. So for Kelly and Scott, I'm Justin. We're out. We will be back, Scott, next Monday night.
Yes.
With our September MSG House show. So right back at it a week from tonight. But otherwise, everyone keep an eye out on PlayStation.com. Follow us on social media for all of the updates throughout the week. All the breaking news and announcements and, of course, socialization of our great written articles and podcast audio. So check all that out. We're out. We'll talk to you in a week. Everyone take care. everyone go find your plowboy and have a good night.
Plowboy.
Enjoy yourselves.